Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, January 9th, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to Eastern, to midnight in Eastern Standard. If you are listening over another network and would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 712-770-4160. Participant code is 385698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. That's questions, plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is Psalms 121, verses 1 through 8, a prayer to keep us. Psalm 121, I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord, which made heaven and earth. We will not suffer thy foot to be moved. He that keepeth thee will not slumber. Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is thy keeper. The Lord is thy shade upon thy right hand. The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. The Lord shall preserve thy going out and thy coming in, from this time forth, and even forevermore. Psalms 121, verses 1 through 8. Okay, now let's see. Tonight, as we've been mentioned before the holiday came in, we did file the papers up in the federal court up here in Albany, New York. We've been working on writing some other papers, and we're getting ready to start serving these papers. I think we have 45 days to serve, or something like that. So, but anyway, we did file before the holiday, and now we're about ready to start serving papers. So I think tomorrow we'll be sending them out. Tonight we got two papers, short papers, that we're going to read through. One is. Court is to take judicial cognizance, and the other one is to show cause. So let's look at the court is to take judicial cognizance. You can find a copy of this up at nationallibertyalliance.org /docket or highlight grand jury and click on docket, and you'll be able to find all of our papers that we're filing with the court. I'm not sure whether we've read them all. I'll have to go through to see if there's any in here we haven't read. We've got quite a few. I don't think we have read them all. But we have, including the summons, we have 17 papers. And of course, we also have a table of contents up there, which is included as a number, list of defendants, statement of jurisdiction. And this is really a judicial notice to the magistrate. Again, it's called the judicial notice, or court is to take judicial cognizance. they've sent us some papers as if we were a pro se and kind of setting the stage, I think, the attitude of the judge to us. And that's why we wrote this paper, to make it clear that we're not a court of record. We also had a problem with the clerk up there, and we, again, want to make it clear we are a court of record. And we're not coming in there for a judge to make any kind of a decision on a case. This is a trial. Anything we're going to get involved with will be trial by jury. Okay, so judicial notice. You can find a copy. It is, it's numbered 1002, judicial notice to magistrate, right under papers filed, on nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. So anybody wants to follow along. These are short papers. This is only about 6 pages, and the other one's only 2 pages, so we should get through them quite quickly. Okay, judicial notice. Court is to take judicial cognizance. We, the people, have been providentially provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of persons themselves entrusted to dispense justice. In the Supreme Court case of the United States versus Williams, give the number, Justice Antonin Scalia, writing for the majority, confirmed that the American grand jury is neither part of the judicial, executive, nor legislative branches of government, but instead belongs to the people. It is, in effect, the fourth branch of government, governed and administered to directly by and on behalf of the American people, and its authority emanates from the Bill of Rights. The court further said, thus, citizens have the unbridled right to impanel their own grand juries and present true bills of indictment to a court, which is then required to commence a criminal proceeding. Our founding fathers thereby created a buffer the people may rely upon for justice when public officials, including judges, criminally violate the law. And, of course, this is exactly why we filed the case the way we did. We're not getting anywhere with them. So we filed the case, and we're going to do it through this court case. Because the grand jury is an institution separate from the courts, over whose functioning the courts do not preside, we think it clear that, as a general matter at least, no supervisory judicial authority exists. Rooted in a long century of Anglo-American history, Hanna versus Lotch, the grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights but not in the body of the Constitution. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches described in the first three articles. It is a constitutional fixture in its own right. In fact, the whole theory of its function is that it belongs to no branch of the institutional government, serving as a kind of buffer or referee between the government and the people. Although the grand jury normally operates, of course, in the courthouse and under judicial auspices, its institutional relationship with the judicial branch has traditionally been, so to speak, at arm's length. Judges' direct involvement in the functioning of the grand jury has generally been confined to the constitutive one of calling the grand jurors together, the administering of their oaths to office. The grand jury requires no authorization from its constituting court to initiate an investigation, nor does the prosecutor require leave of court to seek a grand jury indictment. And in its day-to-day functioning, the grand jury generally operates without interference of a presiding judge. It swears in its own witnesses. The grand jury remains free to pursue its investigation, unhindered by external influence or supervision, so long as it does not trench upon the legitimate right of any witnesses called before it. Recognizing this tradition of independence, we have said that the Fifth Amendment's constitutional guarantee presupposes an investigative body acting independently of either prosecuting attorney or judge. Passage of the Unconstitutional Organic Act of 1871 and all latter construction upon it that judges have covertly used to seize control of our federal district courts in an effort to bypass the law of the land in order to ensure the abusive will of the state was an act of treason, thereby warring against the Constitution and we the people. Therefore, it is null and void. We judges have no more right to decline the exercise of jurisdiction which is given than to usurp that which is not given. The one or the other would be treason to the Constitution, Cohen versus Virginia. This is an extraordinary process. This is a case concerning subversion by enemies both foreign and domestic within our government, including our federal judiciary. We the people have reported these subversions over the past year in all 94 federal district courts through informations, and the federal judiciary has not acted upon them. We the people over the past year have served writs upon all servants within our federal government demanding obedience to the law of the land, and have filed said writs in all 94 federal district courts, and the responses have been a deafening silence. as our elected servants continue to in their lawlessness. Therefore, we the people proceed as follows. Number one, this is a court of record under the people's own authority. See statement of jurisdiction, and will proceed according to the rules of common law. See the common law handbook. A copy can be found at nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. Federal rules, too. Federal rules will be adhered to as much as they are not repugnant to the law of the land. Three, the common law grand jury is normally comprised of 25 people. Due to the nature of this case, there are approximately 6,000 jurists representing all 50 states that make up this grand jury. When called into session, a quorum will be made up of 100 people. The grand jury will appoint four administrators hereinafter, the sureties of peace, who will administer and advise the juries when called upon by the jury foreman of the trial jury. The trial juries, number four, the trial juries will be made up of 12 people chosen from a pool that the federal district court already adheres to. The grand jury will provide an appropriate questionnaire. When cases become ripe for trial, the sureties of peace will call upon the magistrate to muster a jury, and the jury will be orientated by the sureties of the peace. Five, judges are magistrates in courts of record and are entrusted with the administration of the law, whereas the people will decide both the facts and the law through an untainted jury chosen according to the common law. Be advised that the federal grand jury and jury handbooks are repugnant to the common law and thereby null and void. See 1011 Memorandum Jury Tampering and Stacking, found at nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. Magistrates are to make no ruling without leave of the sovereigns of the court. 6. When elected servants are called upon to answer the people demand for a redress of grievances, they are to answer in a sworn affidavit directly and not through an attorney. Any unsworn answers through an attorney will be considered a non-answer. Elected and appointed servants have a duty to speak. Silence will be equated with fraud and will be brought before the grand jury for consideration for indictment. After indictment, the prosecutor will give the defendant a copy of the indictment at the arraignment and the voluntary disclosure form, which includes information about the case, such as the date, time, place of the crime, and of the arrest. The defendant will be informed about the substance of his statements and of his identification. The defendant will then enter a plea of guilty or not guilty to the indictment. Bail may be reviewed and different conditions may be set. 7. The sureties of the peace will appoint a special prosecutor. 8. Once indicted, servants will be removed from office and have a right to counsel. If they cannot afford legal counsel, they can petition the court, and if they qualify, the court will provide counsel. 9. It is the duty of all magistrates to exercise the power vested in them for the good of the people, according to the law and with zeal and fidelity. A neglect on the part of a magistrate to exercise the functions of his office when required by law is a misdemeanor. Sealed and dated, we dated this one to January 5th, 2017. And again, papers will be accompanying all the other papers that we filed, and we'll be filing that paper also. Right now, the only papers we actually filed were the papers to the three branches of government. We've got quite a few other papers, as you see up here. They're all going to be filed within the next day or so when we're serving them. Okay, the second paper, when we went up there, they charged us $400, and we, of course, rejected and told them we don't pay for justice, and they demanded the $400. We did want to get it filed, so we did give them the $400, and now we're demanding it back. We wrote a paper. It's a show cause. It's directed to the clerk of the court, Lawrence Barman. So we added that clerk to the case, And it's a show cause, and I'm just going to read it. It's only 2 pages. It's very short. On December 14, 2016, we the people filed papers in the above court, opening a court of record. However, the clerk demanded $400 in return for justice. After notifying the clerk that this is a common law procedure and therefore not held under statutory requirements, we directed the clerk to file under penalty of law, unimpeded as required by law under Rule 4, and without charge, under American jurisprudence, constitutional law, subsection 326. We notified the clerk of the consequences of 18 U.S.C. 2076 and 18 U.S.C. 1512. The clerk continued to insist that money should be given in exchange for justice. See file and demand attached. We made it clear that we the people, we are the people and are not fictions or subjects. Plaintiff should not be charged fees or costs for the lawful constitutional right to petition this court in this manner, in which he is entitled to relief, as it appears that the filing fee rule was originally implemented for fiction and subjects of the state, and should not be applied to the plaintiffs, who is a natural individual and entitled to relief. Hale versus Henkel. A system of justice is an institution for the redress of grievances. It can only command the respect of a society's members if they trust that it is an impartial, equal, transparent, and principled system, and gives effect to the rule of law. These necessary qualities of any system of justice worthy of that name were revealed in the Magna Carta that promised, "To no one will we sell, to no one will we deny or defer right of justice." Wherefore, we the people demand that Lawrence K. Berman, clerk of the court, show cause by what authority the clerk may charge for justice, or admit to their error, return the money, and we will forego bringing the defendant before the grand jury for extortion. Sealed and dated January 9th, 2017. Okay, so those papers will be going in tomorrow, and we will be serving accordingly over the course of the week. So we need to start to get the word out, to get as many people as possible to become aware of these papers, to start reading these papers and get involved and get behind us. Now is the time we really need to get, that push. We need the people. Okay, Jan, I see you're here. Do we have any questions?
We do have 2 questions and 1 comment. You ready for questions?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. Number 1, should the other Colorado U.S. senator be listed to be contacted about Joe Robertson's medical treatment? And that would be Senator Michael Barnett. He's the other senator. He's known not to be particularly friendly to what we're trying to do. Now, I did notice when I looked up his particulars that he has a note attached to his website that says, "Please note, mail service to our Washington office is significantly delayed due to heightened security measures. Please send any time-sensitive correspondence via the form below or call us at our office phone number." So I don't know if that's in preparation for the inauguration or whether that's a continuing thing. So if we're sending stuff to the D.C. office, we have to allow a little extra time or get a hold of whoever we send it to. So the question is, should we contact Michael Bennett as well as Cory Gardner?
The federal rules require 60 days for elected individuals to be served. That's far above the 20 days that it normally, if they're served in person. 30 days if they're not personally served, served through other processes or out of the state. But they'll have 60 days to receive the papers. We're going through, of course, the leadership of the House, and we'll be utilizing their faxes. Look, they're game that they play. It's exactly what it is, the game. They're trying to prevent communications is what they want to do. They want to be without risk. That's my conclusion of the way that they've set systems up. They do not want you to have an email address. They want you to go to their website and send an email from the website. Thereby, you know, how are you going to get to, if you want to send a message to all of them, you know, it's just not possible anymore. We've got their fax numbers. I know, heard that possibly some of these fax numbers have been changed since we've been faxing. But we've got the up-to-date, the latest fax numbers to all of the offices of all of the elected individuals. And there'll be no excuse as far as being served. We will be serving the leadership of the House in paper on behalf of the whole body of both houses. And, of course, all of the other elected officials will be serving directly in paper the Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court, and also, of course, the President, serving him directly also. So that's the process. We're not going to go after a senator or a congressman trying to convince them to do anything on our behalf. They're aware. They know. They will be more aware once this case is filed or served upon them and these issues come up, especially with Robinson. They're going to become aware. They should do the right thing. We'll eventually get around to those individuals that are not doing the right thing. But the people we're really going to focus in on and go after is the judge. Look, he's the responsible one, or she's the responsible. I think it's a male judge. I don't remember. But the judge is the responsible one. So is the U.S. attorney, and so is the U.S. marshal. These are the people that are breaking the law. These are the people that are assaulting us on a daily basis. These are the people that are, you know, locking people up without real cause. And none of these people are getting due process. Absolutely none have ever gotten due process of any of the cases we're involved with. So now they got to answer, and we'll see how that goes. They don't have a choice. They know how it works, and now that the paperwork has been filed and everything is set in place, the law requires them to answer. And so we're going to see how that goes with that, and we'll see how they answer. We also are going to write a letter, which we'll send a copy to the U.S. attorney. Whenever you file a federal case against anyone who is an elected individual or an appointed individual or even employed, I guess, also, you have to copy the U.S. attorney. Well, this is a common law procedure. We don't have to do that, but we'll let them know anyway. And we'll send them a full copy of the case, but we're also going to, you know, silence him. He's not permitted to speak in this court because if he comes in to represent someone, then all he's doing is participating with the fraud against the people by creating a filter and a non-answer to the people. These are, an address for grievances, and we have questions and we want answers. They have a duty to answer us, and if they do not answer us, they're guilty of fraud. That's the law. That's what the Supreme Court has ruled numerous times. When they have a duty to speak and they remain silent, that's fraud. If they sidestep it, it's fraud. If they try to get a lawyer to answer through a filter, a non-answer, that's fraud. And fraud puts them in bad behavior. Bad behavior allows us to be able to remove them from office. So that's how we're going to proceed, and the Robinson case is one of our first and foremost cases we're going to push, along with the Oregon case up there, and also we're looking to see what's going to be going on down in Nevada with the Bundy Ranch situation, and of course our habeas corpuses that we've set through the process, and we've got the clerk and the judge we've got to deal with, and so we've got a lot of people. If you look at our list of defendants, we have hundreds of people as list of defendants. We also have John Doe's and Mary Doe's, because we will be adding people as we go. And so we're very well prepared to go forward with this case, and we'll see how it goes. Okay, any other questions?
Yes. Number two, in the discussion, and this goes back a couple of weeks, about a right being a responsibility. Can Brent give us a practical application example to better understand what a right is a responsibility, or that a right is a responsibility? So if society has misinterpreted the meaning of rights, we would like to have a specific understanding of society's misrepresentation of rights.
Frank, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. If I can, if I'm heard, I'll keep talking. Am I heard? Yes, okay. Well, prime example is the one where we've been talking about the last few weeks, last few months, many months now, the right, supposed misunderstood right, to keep and carry a gun. That's a responsibility. Self-defense is an affirmative responsibility, and so we call it a right. That's a good example, and there are many others. But I'd like to add, too, that historically, to come back to the word, our common law is our constitution. It is our constitution. We have a written constitution, and our written constitution is a slice of our unwritten constitution called our common law. And a common law rights our responsibilities. Our common law used to be called, here's another instance, the name of it, before it was called our common law, before it was called, as Magna Carta put it in the Latin tongue, the law of the land, due process, it was called the Volkrecht, the Volkrecht in the Germanic tongue of Anglo-Saxon and Anglo-Dane. And the Volk are the folk, the people, we say today. The word for people in the Germanic tongue is Volk, like the Volkswagen. We used to drive a car called the people's car, the Volkswagen. It's a wagon. That's their word for car, and Volk is the people. So we say folk. But the Volkreich was the people's duty, because government at common law is not the duty of paid office holders and bureaucrats. In that day, and we could approximate this today, and the more we could approximate it, the better off we'd be. If government were our responsibility, primarily under two duties, the people's duty, armed defense, called the militia by our constitutional clauses, our constitution's clauses, armed defense and jury duty, grand and petit. Those are the two duties of the people. That is government of the people, by the people, and for the people, you see. And the people that don't receive a salary from that, once a stipend is added to it, it's no longer the people's duty. It is no longer the people's right. It is no longer the folk right. It becomes a hired fellow's duty, and pretty soon he's going to be setting things up, those fellows that are kept by the government. They're going to be setting things up so they can milk more money for themselves and their friends. And that's what we face today. And this should be no secret to people that think this through. It cannot not last. It has never lasted in the history of the world where the right, that is the duty, the responsibility of government, is taken from the people. And if you'll notice, that's what they're doing. They're saying, you don't worry about protecting yourself. You have no responsibility. You have no jurisdiction to protect yourself. You must call the members of the police state to protect you. Well, the right to keep and bear arms, understood in its ancient etymology, which we ought to understand it, and the meaning it had when it was used, when our Constitution used it, is duty. That's just one good example. Here's another one. You have a right to free speech. You have a right to remain silent. Both of those are duties. Why do I say they're duties? Because God, like the right to self-protection and protection of your family, it's given to you direct from God. That means it's a fundamental right. What does that mean? That means it's a duty. You have a duty to exercise discretion over your tongue to either speak, freedom of speech, or not to speak. Now, they were just mentioned a minute ago. John mentioned a duty to speak. He was saying that the law says that some people have a duty to speak. That's true. And if the court says you don't have the right to remain silent, you have a duty to speak, and you disagree, even the court may throw you in contempt and jail for contempt to see if you're serious. Not a criminal problem, but it'll test your mettle. But you must be convicted. You have jurisdiction over your tongue. You have jurisdiction. That's another word for right. They're synonyms. That means duty. That means every time you must speak or not speak, you must make a choice. It is the duty of exercise and discretion. That takes us to another step. The duty of a free man is discretion. There are only two kinds of education in the world, and never have been any more than two kinds. There have been educations for slaves. Those are folk that are taught to obey their masters. And then there is the education, Augustine said, back about the year 400 A.D., it became very popular, still is today, an education for freedom. And the words are now used from the old Latin, a liberal education. And we've forgotten entirely what that means. We think it means going to college someplace and taking certain courses. That's not it at all. Liberal means liberty, the old way of saying it. It's an education for freedom. What's an education for freedom? It's an education that hones a man's skills to exercise sound discernment. It is his duty. I was involved in a case once where it came down to a trustee, and the beneficiary wanted a distribution. And the trustee refused his duty. What was his duty? His duty was to exercise discretion. He had to either say yes or no, but he wouldn't say neither. So the matter went to court, and the judge said, you have a duty. You have a duty to exercise discretion. I want you to do it, and I'm ordering you to do it, and if you don't do it, you'll be held in contempt. Will you or will you not make this distribution? It was a discretionary trust. He had the right to say yes or no. The right, there's that word again, that means the duty. And he said no. And the judge said, case closed. He did his duty, and that ends it. You drug him into court to force him to do his duty, and he did. He exercised discretion. And to have the ability to have honed your skills and exercising discretion, as the writer to the Hebrews says at the end of chapter 5, you exercised your discernment of discretion to fulfill your duty. What does a judge do? A judge is a man that exercises discretion. It's a discretionary job. He's supposed to be educated to the task, and he's supposed to say yes or no. A juryman, by the way, must exercise discretion. That's a duty. He must say, yes, Mr. Government, you can enforce this man's rights, or no, you may not. Yes, you may take this man's life, liberty, property, or a combination thereof, or no, you may not. That's a jury's duty, a grand juryman's duty. He must exercise discretion. He has a right, that is a duty, to say, yes, you may try this man for his life, liberty, or property, or no, you may not. Discretion is the mark of a free man. And being trained to obey without discretion is the mark of a slave. By the way, at bureaucratic law, administrative law, the maxim of administrative law, the law of the bureaucrat, the IRS, the CIA, the FBI, those men have no discretion. Agents of government have no discretion as a matter of law. No, they must follow persnickedly, if I can invent a word. They must follow exactly, precisely. They're hemmed in to the regulations. They're hemmed in to the executive orders, supposedly. That's the law. They do not have, they are, as James Otis said, one of the men of Revolutionary War fame, they are ignorant clerks. They're just clerks. They don't have discretion. Jurors have discretion. Judges have discretion. And every man who has freemanship exercises discretion. You know, when you're in prison, people have done studies. Men don't make choices. They don't have any choices to make. And to stay in prison is really hard on you because it takes away from you your exercise of discretion. You don't get to choose what you eat, and you don't get to choose what you wear day by day. We don't think about it. We get up in the morning, we choose what clothes we wear. That's a choice. We exercise discretion. And to get out of that habit of not exercising discretion, to be nothing but a lowly clerk, to be a slave, destroys your personality. Destroys it. That's why it's important to exercise discretion. Milton Friedman used to say, Freedom is about exercising discretion, making choices. He was right on that point. But a right is a duty, and this is more precise than I put it last time, but we're just getting into the subject. A right is a duty to exercise discretion. You must say no, you must say yes. You must choose this, you must choose that. That's the mark of a free man, is to have that kind of a duty. And the examples, to wrap it up at the end, sum up in the end here, the examples of such rights are the right, duty, the responsibility of self-defense, encapsulated in our Second Amendment and the other three militia clauses, the right, the duty of absolute government over your tongue. No one can ever take that away from you. They can talk you out of it, but they can't take it away from you. You have a duty before God to speak when God wants you to speak, when you believe he wants you to speak, and keep your mouth shut when he wants you to remain silent. That's your duty, and you must know the difference. You must contemplate and study and discern the mind of God on the answer. And to exercise discretion, as the writer to the Hebrews said, chapter 5, exercise the right, the duty, the responsibility. That's what a right is. Maybe that's a couple of examples, and maybe add some more flesh to the bones than we did last time.
Okay. Thank you, Brent.
I just had...
Let me just make another point on top of that. Brent had mentioned jury, so I'd like to impress upon that idea with the jury that they have a duty to speak also. There is no such thing as a hung jury. It doesn't exist. It exists in the minds of these judges that want to take control of things. If a jury is hung, well, they go back until they unhang themselves. Even if they come to the decision, we're never going to come to an agreement, so why don't we just agree that we have to let this person go, and let's just dismiss the case that way and acquit them. And so that's the final decision. If you got 12 jurors, if 11 are pursuant that the person is guilty, but that one person, no way. Hey, benefit of the doubt must go to the individual at some point in time, or they just continue there until they make a decision. And that is what really I believe the common law is. All right, Jen, go ahead.
Yeah. Tonight we have Robert on tap to give us an update on what's happening in the Western states. Is this a good time for that?
Sure. Go right ahead.
Robert, you're on. I unmuted you, Robert. Can you hear us?
Maybe he stepped away from his computer?
No, I was just chatting with him on Skype. I would not think he stepped away.
Yeah, Robert, you've been unmuted. Your box is unblocked, unchecked, so you can hear us. All right, well, when he gets back to the mic, he can pipe in. If he doesn't do so before Brent takes over, then we'll ask again for him to take
okay.
the mic. Do we have anything else or anyone else that has any
no.
comments to be made here?
No more questions
Nothing
or anything
else.
Or any other people. Okay.
Okay. All right. By the way, we did put up on our web on our docket page, we now have the one habeas corpus that we filed for Robinson. As a matter of fact, all the papers that we filed for Robinson is on this page because we're going to be doing show causes to these individuals on by what authority they think they can ignore the law, ignore due process, and ignore we the people, and just do whatever they please and throw people in prison. So we do have the motion to release we also have an appeal paper that we wrote for Mr. Robinson. And we have the habeas corpus. They did default on that habeas corpus. So we have filed the default. And that's where we're at with that, and we'll be pursuing that case. Okay. Is there any other questions or comments or anything? Or is that it, Jen?
No, that was it.
Okay.
Did Robert come back?
I want to remind you. Go ahead,
no,
Jen.
I thought Robert was sending me a message, but I guess not. So he must be away from his phone.
Okay. All right. I want to remind people, to take a look to see if they want to become jury administrators. We need 4 administrators for every county. It's a paid position. Of course, that position is not available at the moment, but people need to become educated at this point in time, prepare for that if they're interested in that, because we intend on taking away this the authority of these people, this self-given authority ultimately. And really, it's we the people didn't step up to take this on our own. So now we are, and that is the orientation and the bringing together of a jury. Only the people can do this. We don't want a political individual in there. We don't want a servant who is paid by the government, who owes their allegiance to the government and, is expecting a paycheck from the government. So we can't allow those people make these decisions because they'll always go for the state the people unconnected from this process, of the political process, that is, need to be the ones to make sure that the juries are open to anybody. Anybody should be able to come see the jury. They should be able to make an appointment to, if they want to see a grand jury and talk to them. That's a right of the people. And the grand jury must be free, as much as the trial jury must be free, untainted, untouched by the judge and or the prosecutor. So anyway, we are looking for four people in every county, and people don't necessarily have to work in a county they live in. If the positions are filled, they can go to the next county over, may even be closer to them, because it's really a job. Okay, also we're building committees of safety. Hopefully everyone is considering and looking into that to get involved in their own county. If they don't have a committee of safety, they need to get involved and get one going. Even if they don't want to run it, you get involved to get it sparked up and get it going. Look for leadership and then participate as much as you can. Or just take the leadership yourself. Let's get something going on the grassroots. Let's get a connection with the sheriff and the local elected officials, and let's teach these people humbly, but teach them that they are the servants. They need to be serving us. That's what they're there for. They have a duty to serve. You know, they're not there for prestige. They're not there because they're someone special. They're not there for the power or the authority. They're there to serve the people. Let's see. I think that's all I've got. If there's nothing else, we'll move over to Brent. There's nothing else, Jen?
Yeah, it looks like Robert's online now. I see some noise coming out of his channel. Are you there, Robert? Oops. I wonder if he has a mic problem.
Yeah, if you're there, Robert, your mic is unmuted. All right, well, we'll try him again after Brent, about a half hour, so we'll see where he's at then. Okay, let's move over to Brent Winters. Brent Winters is going to take the mic for a while and talk to us about something, and then people will be able to ask questions. Brent is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent?
Hello?
Can you hear me? Yep, go right ahead, Brent. Oh, is that Robert or Brent?
That's Robert. Yeah, we got him, I guess.
All right, go ahead, Robert. Then we'll move to Brent. You had some announcements to make or something.
I've been shifting headsets around. Okay, I think things are about to get very interesting around here. Both Nevada and Portland. In Nevada, some of the word coming out from there is that Judge Navarro has said that she will not allow the Constitution in her court. So, therefore, another judge committing treason.
Is this a recent statement or the one made inside the courtroom?
That's just here like a week ago, last week.
Okay. If someone does an affidavit on that, get us the information, and the more affidavits we can get on that, well, let's do it, and let's do a show cause and bring her into our court case for war, making war against the Constitution. So if anybody could do an affidavit, or if you could get us an affidavit on that, I'd like to get this one into our court case.
Yeah, I've got people on that. Okay. And then the next thing out of Nevada is... one of the Bundy brothers, not Ammon or Ryan, but I think his name is Mel. He's never even been indicted yet, but he's been held in prison all these months, even though he hasn't been indicted. And he asked to be released on bail, and he was refused, and the excuse for refusing is the fact that he's a Bundy. And
is that literally what they said?
That's what they're telling me.
Now, if we can get someone to do an affidavit on that, there again, that's something else we want to pull into the case. This was to put our foot in the door of their case
And they are,
we need to stop putting the pressure on.
They're using the excuse that if she was to release any of the Bundys on bail, there would be hundreds of federal officials that would be in danger of their lives.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, again, affidavits, affidavits, affidavits. I'd love to get affidavits on this, but go ahead, Robert.
Yeah. Well, now, in that trial is going to start in February. The second trial in Portland is going to be starting on February 14th. On the 20th of this month, see, we had a status hearing this past Friday, and we have another status hearing on Inauguration Day. And on this past Friday, the first defendant up was the attorney Mumford, who at the end of the last trial was attacked by the marshals and stun gun used on him. And he came to court, and he had him a pack of attorneys with him. The attorneys are gathering to stand in solidarity with him. It could get interesting before this one's over. The prosecutors are not even sure that the charges on him are going to stay the same as has been written. And there's another interesting point. And this is one of the reasons for the status hearing on the 20th, is the judge telling the prosecutors to get their act together. And it seems that, you know, we saw the not guilty vote on the first seven. And so they kind of figured that the second group would get the same thing. So they decided to throw in some misdemeanor charges.
Does anyone know if these misdemeanor charges was brought over to the grand jury for approval?
Well, I don't think so, because on Friday they said again, well, we're not sure that, but at court time those are going to be the same charges. We may change those misdemeanor charges to something else.
Okay, right there. That right there is a crime. And we need to get an affidavit on that statement, because unless they go before the grand jury to get that approval, they're the ones that have to indict, not the prosecutor. They're the ones that have to agree that there's some charge here that has merit, that these people need to go into a court. Of course, the grand jury they get is a stacked grand jury anyway, but that's an important thing to get in an affidavit, because, again, we then can go after these other, the prosecutor also. We want to go after the prosecutor because
I've been hitting people hard for affidavits ever since Friday.
Okay.
But
by the way, Robert, before you continue, we do have a copy of the habeas corpus we did out there for Robinson. Maybe you can get that going out there and hand it out to the people to see, let them see what we're doing, and that we need their help of affidavits to help them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Another interesting tidbit about the misdemeanor charges. Judge Anna Brown is saying this last Friday that the main charges will have a jury, but the misdemeanor charges will not be discussed during that trial. But as soon as the main trial is over, they will dismiss the jury, and she will handle the trial for the misdemeanor charges.
I can't believe that. Is this a federal court? Are we talking about a federal court? What planet?
Oh, yes. Yep.
Okay, you know, this is, again, I really hope we can get affidavits on this. Just think about what she's saying. You know, the Constitution requires a jury. If there's a criminal, any offense that could put a person's life or limb in jeopardy, it means put in jail or even their life taken, but in this case put in jail, even fined, okay, That must be for before a jury. The jury must decide, not the government, not an elected or an appointed individual. She's appointed, and she doesn't have that power or authority. Make sure that gets into any affidavits we can.
We're making sure that the defendants demand a jury. We're not going to let them go
without. Well, we will do a show cause and demand it from this perspective and put them before another court to answer. So, again, affidavits is the key. These people aren't going to answer to anyone. I can see and hear that. I do know I've heard this, and I don't know what this means yet, but it's like wait and see or something. I don't know. But I heard that Trump is going to be speaking on the 11th, and he's going to be addressing some of these issues out west. Which is with this case out there with the Bundys and Oregon case particularly. But
yes, I do understand he is, yes.
Yeah, so these people, I don't understand what planet they're on. They think they're going to get away with this. They are so bold. We have to do something really hardcore on these people. And when I say hardcore, I mean let's get them before in front of a court where they have to answer. Well, let's get these papers. But go ahead. I'm sorry for it.
We have... We have trolls already infiltrating through our people out here, and today it came out that one of them was telling Jeanette Finnicum, the wife of Lavoie, that he told her that he wanted to die, and that there was no doubt about he was going to die because he wanted to. And just, you know, just harassment of Mrs. Finnicum. It's really getting low life out here with some of these people. So.
Hey, well, again, these people need to answer, and I think they need to be in jail, but that's not for me to decide. That'll be for a jury.
Well, it's... Things are going to get hot. Things are going to get exciting, and I think some judges are going down. They're just openly walking right into treason.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was pretty bad that they accused the Bundys. None of them have ever been convicted of anything. But if they release them, they're going to be out killing feds. Hundreds of them.
Well, again, even guilty by association. That's what they're saying, and that's insane.
Obama putting, doing that land grab for monuments, made sure that it included the Bundys' grazing areas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something else. I pray that Trump reverses real quick.
Well, again, he's only got so much power, but he can do something. And look at just the fact that he's going to talk about it. We hope, at least that's what we're hearing. Just the fact that he's going to talk about it and put some attention towards it will help us. I mean, he is limited to some degree, and. But on the other hand, you know, look at these. This is the federal agents that are doing these things. He has appointed these judges. They are warring against the Constitution. He has a duty, if he can understand it, that they are warring against the Constitution, to make that note to them that they are warring against the Constitution, that they need to either, you know, repent their error or face potential arrest and indictment for subversion against the United States, because it's exactly what they're guilty of. Subversion against the people, warring against the Constitution. These are crimes.
I don't know whether it's fake news or what. I haven't had a chance to check it out, but the word I got today is that there's an international arrest warrant out for Obama and President Bush.
Well, I wouldn't doubt that, but it's not going to go anywhere. We know that. But we'll get them in the end anyway. You know, and if we don't, God will. You know,
Congress voted also to strip Obama of all power until after, for the rest of his time in office.
What? Say that again?
I read an article where it says Congress passed a bill through both houses stripping Obama of all of his power until for the rest of his time in office.
They'd have to impeach him. They'd have an impeachment process to do that.
Right.
And even there, you know, it's got to be pretty strong charges, and I'm sure they can find them. They don't have the backbone to really go after him against the real charges of his guilt. But there's no way that one elected group can make law or something to prevent another elected individual from doing what they believe is their duty. That must be something somebody speaking. They have no clue what they're talking about.
Right. Well, I'm just hoping that it would take more than just their vote to do it, but I'm hoping that it is an indication that they're gonna oppose him the rest of his time.
Again, it takes an impeachment. I mean, Congress has the power to have hearings and impeach the president. I mean, they have that authority. But that's what they have to do. They have to impeach him. And then I'm not sure, you know, where they can go or how far they can go with that. But they can remove him from office. But he's coming out of office anyway. He's at the end. All right, anything else, Robert?
No, that's all I got. I just needed to get those points out there about the judges and the prosecutors too, changing charges around and everything. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Right.
Totally unconstitutional.
Yeah, that I'd love to see that in affidavits, because they got to answer for that. I also want to know. I want to see, because I've seen the indictment, and the indictments that I've seen have no signature on it. They have the signatures of the U.S. attorney and some other individual, which is a witness of an attorney also. But there is no form in there. I don't think they ever went before a grand jury. I think they bypassed it. They're just saying they went through it, and they did it. I wonder how long they've been doing that for. Yeah, anytime I see an indictment without a signature of a foreman, there's something wrong here.
But it's also out that with Joe Robertson, he's not the only case of being abused there in that detention center. Seems like most everyone in there, and some of them been there for years, and they're all getting the same treatment that Joe Robertson is getting.
Yeah, it's an evil system they got going. So
all
right.
There's the work. That's all
right,
I have.
Thanks a lot, Robert. Thank you. Okay, anybody else that's out there that's aware of these things that Robert is talking about and would like to do an affidavit, get a hold of Robert or get a hold of Jan. You can find Jan up on our website under the directory. You should be towards the top. You can give him a call or drop him an email. Okay, let's move over to Brent now. Brent, you got the mic. Did we lose Brent? No, we didn't. You're still muted, Brent. *6. Unmute yourself.
Well,
there you go.
Here I am, John. Hey, yeah,
we got
thank you.
You.
Yeah, thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity, as always. Say a few words, and I appreciate questions and responses. And everything I say may or may not be the position of NLA, but I found that most of our positions are pretty compatible, consonant, I like to say, and where they aren't, we can discuss them. But at any rate, we're talking about some serious business. I'm glad for that update. I wasn't aware that they had arrested the U.S. Marshals, arrested this Marcus M. Mumford, lawyer for Ammon Bundy. And so I pulled up an article about it while you were talking about it. And I want to read here real quick what this article says. This is disturbing in the extreme. The U.S. District Judge told Mr. Mumford, this lawyer for Ammon Bundy, that the U.S. Marshals had a hold on his client, who had just been acquitted, had a hold on him for a federal indictment down in Nevada. The lawyer said, Mr. Mumford, he said, no, he's released on these charges. He's acquitted. Nevada does not have jurisdiction. He yelled these things in the courtroom standing before the judge. He said, if there's a detainer for my client, show me. And the judge then chided him for yelling in the courtroom and told Mumford that Bundy will be released on all federal holds in the Oregon case, but he'll have to take up any questions about the federal holds from Nevada with the U.S. Marshal Service. And Mumford, the lawyer for Ammon Bundy, said, if they want him, they know where to find him. And he said, I don't see any paperwork proving the marshal's authority to hold him. And at that point, a group of a half a dozen U.S. Marshals who had been standing or seated around the perimeter of the courtroom slowly moved in and surrounded Mumford at the defense table where he stood. The judge directed them to move back, but moments later, the marshals piled onto him. And, of course, then they ended up tasing him a few times. And then the judge cleared the courtroom immediately. He was taken into custody. And what I understand now is he's under arrest for disobeying a lawful order. But when you're in the courtroom and you're arguing a case and he has a duty to argue vigorously for his client, and if the judge doesn't like the way he does it, the judge has the power to hold him in contempt. But as long as a lawyer doesn't exhibit any violence in the courtroom, that should be the extent of it. And U.S. Marshals have nothing to do with it. The U.S. Marshals were ordered to back off, according to the information I'm reading, and the U.S. Marshals didn't. They piled on top of this fella and have charged him now. This is disturbing. It should be disturbing to everyone. If there is not freedom of speech, the freedom to exercise discretion over your tongue in the courtroom, number one, and in the pulpit, in religious gatherings, number two, then freedom of speech is gone. And a lawyer arguing for his client must have freedom to do so without fear of arrest, because if he can't, it chills his right. What is his right? It is his responsibility, his jurisdiction, his duty to exercise discretion in arguing for the defense of his client. And that goes for all of us. We have a duty, a right, a jurisdiction to argue for what is right, to petition the government. That's a form of freedom of speech, to file a paper with a court or with a legislator or with an executive. So this is not small potatoes. This is big stuff, what they've done here. And I'm surprised that men who have taken an oath, such as U.S. Marshals, to support and defend the Constitution, I'm surprised, I guess. I shouldn't be. After all these years, I'm surprised they don't take it a little bit serious. I don't think they give it a thought. They just do whatever keeps them their jobs. That's what I notice about them. Well, to the law, we're talking about the militia clauses. By the way, the four militia clauses of our Constitution are the answer to such a police state bureaucratic-minded attitude among government-kept men. Well, Lord John Emmerich Edward Dalberg Acton, he who never quotes is never quoted, so I'm going to quote him again. He's a good man to quote. He had thought a lot of things through. He said this: there is no error so monstrous that it fails to find defenders among the ablest of men. There is no error so monstrous that it fails to find defenders among the ablest of men. This situation with this lawyer, Mumford, it's not like there's a difference of opinion here about what happened or what should happen. And anyone who would argue otherwise is brainless. They've put their brain in a bucket and fired a 45 slug into it, so to speak. That's madness. No, you don't tackle and arrest and tase lawyers for making arguments in defense of their clients' rights. Their clients' rights. That's right. Responsibility. Turn him loose, his liberty, where he can exercise discretion, do his duty. Now we're talking about the militia clauses. By the time a thief has his gun at your head or has kidnapped you or somebody you know, your family, it's too late to call the police. Further, if you don't raise the hue and the cry, and a policeman does hear you, chances are slim to none he will risk his life or his limb or a scrap of his hide to protect you. In fact, it is true that contrary to police state propaganda, a policeman's duties do not include protecting anyone, contrary to what they have written all over their police cars all over the country. Protect and serve. That's not their duty. That's not their job description. They're not required to risk any part of their bodies to do it. In fact, they always, and rightfully so, I don't blame them, they wait till they have superior firepower in case of an emergency, and they move in. And a policeman who does risk his life, and there are exceptions, sometimes they will, but I say again, their duty doesn't require it. Their duty is not to protect. Their duty is to enforce. Enforce the law. That's their fundamental duty. A policeman will call backup and wait till the risk factor is low enough to suit his safety, in most cases, so he can do that, which is his duty, his right. What is it? Enforce the law, arrest the thief. In this case, we're talking about a man with a gun to your head. He's a thief. Enforce the law, arrest the thief. By that time, though, by the time the policeman decides to arrest the thief, you may well have lost your wallet, or you may well be lying on the ground, ventilated with bullet slugs, or both. And if the thief runs, your wallet will be chucked into the nearest drain or trash can. And if it isn't, the police will keep your wallet for evidence, including the cash, after taking their cut of cash for a handling fee. This is what happens in reality. And you can go to court and see if some judge will get it back for you. Good luck. I know of one fella who called the cops, and the thief accused him and his wife of attempted murder after they called the cops. Attempted murder and extortion. The fella that was accosting them was 6'5", and this woman was a 5'4" grandmother. And she ended up spending 42 days in the L.A. County Jail. And as she says, L.A. is not Lower Alabama, and it wasn't a pleasant experience. But also, before the state prosecutors, this was in California, dropped the state charges for attempted murder, and they did drop them because there was no evidence. They asked the feds if they wanted to have a go at, as they put it, this feminine desperado. And the feds said yes, and that she was eventually then tried in federal court under the Hobbs Act for crossing, and this is the crime, crossing a state line with conspiracy in her heart to commit extortion, which could have, said the court, affected, not effected, but affected interstate commerce. That's silliness, and it's giddiness, and such silly, giddy evil is now pandemic in the government of the United States and throughout our country. The militia of the several states is our Constitution's answer to all such foolish shenanigans, both within and without the ranks of government employees. Americans throughout their history have taken gun ownership to be an obligation. Let me repeat that. Americans throughout their history have taken gun ownership to be an obligation. But even more important than that, a critical mass of Americans have taken it upon themselves to understand the necessity of fundamental rights. Fundamental rights, the very heart of the reason for the militia clauses of our Constitution. And again, there are four militia clauses. A good marriage requires not only that a man know about his wife, A good marriage requires that a man know more than just about his wife. It requires that he study to know his wife. There's a difference between knowing about a thing and knowing a thing. Like the Bible says, Adam knew his wife. Result, she conceived and bore a son. In order for Adam to do that, he had to observe and be respectful of the law, the nature, the law of the female. That's some intimate knowledge. And I make the distinction again, to know about man's wife, he must, to know about her is one thing, but to know her is quite another thing. He must experience her to know her. And he must assert himself to know her. And so also freedom requires not only that you know about your fundamental rights. You can read our Constitution. You can read the court cases about the right to keep and bear arms, the Heller case of D.C. 2008, the McDonald case of Chicago, the companion case of a year or two later. And you'll know about, and they do a good job, by the way, in the Heller decision, of cataloging the history of our Second Amendment going clear back into England, deep into our common law. You can know all about it, but that will not get you to knowing about your fundamental right, your fundamental duty to keep and carry a gun. In order to do that, you must experience it. You must experience it. You must do it. That's the deep, intimate knowledge with your rights that is required to enjoy them. You can't enjoy them unless you experience them. And knowing about them is the necessary first step, not to demean knowing about your rights. It's good to know about your wife, and indeed also it's good for a wife to know about her husband. That's the first step. But then the next step is to experience and to really know them. In both cases, again, I say you must assert yourself to do that. Bottom line, freedom requires that Americans know, not know about, know their rights by living their rights, living their obligations, living their duties, doing the right thing, making the choices of discernment that these fundamental rights, these jurisdictions, these duties require. And doing so requires conviction, discipline, work, and assertive action. That's right. It takes work, but the rewards are exceedingly sweet. Rewards are freedom and escape from the clutches of the police state's dependents. The dependents of this police state. That Americans have remained armed has enabled and kept our freedoms. And as long as people stay armed smartly, the people of the United States will stay free indeed. Indeed, we say also and acknowledge, guns are dangerous. Guns are dangerous. Wow, are they dangerous. I know people that have died from guns unnecessarily. I won't catalog them all, but the stories are sad. But the alternative to not having guns, which is the police state and the inevitable anarchy it always brings, is 1,000 times over worse. Guns are dangerous. Carrying and owning and carrying guns is dangerous. But the alternative, which is the police state, is 1,000 times worse. Because the police state includes disarming all men, anarchy always ensues, allowing false justification of more of the police state. If what government does not work, the only choice government has is to increase more of what does not work. And the only tool government has is force and violence. Force and violence or threat of force and violence. They have no other tool to get their will, its will, I should say. No other tool. And so if force and violence and threat of force and violence doesn't work, the only option they have is to crank up the threat of force and violence. And that's what we see happening. So we're drawn down to the end of this part of it, the part of the discussion. So I want to draw a conclusion, if I may, to the whole matter. And the conclusion that I want to draw is this. I don't know who's listening to these presentations, so I'll just cite a few people that are in visible positions. If you're a congressman or you know one, I would suggest that you get a copy of the book, Militia of the Several States, Our Constitution's Answer to Its Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. Get a copy of that book, if you're a congressman or know a congressman, and read Section 1, and then follow your duty under the first militia clause. If you're a state legislator, get a copy of this book about the four militia clauses, and read Section 2, and then follow your duty under the second militia clause. If you are a president of the United States or in contemplating trying to be one, or you know somebody that is or is contemplating such a thing, read Section 3 of this book concerning the four militia clauses, and then follow your duty under the third militia clause. The first militia clause concerns the duties, the responsibilities, the rights of congressmen. The second militia clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16, concerns the duties, the rights, the jurisdiction, the obligations of state legislators concerning that militia clause. And then Section 3 of that book concerns that class of persons called presidents and their obligations, duties, responsibilities, rights, jurisdiction, the responsibility to exercise discernment under the third militia clause, Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1. Now, if you are one of the people of the United States able-bodied to keep and carry a gun, to serve on the jury, then read Section 4 of this book concerning the four militia clauses, and then be assertive. Read Section 4. That's the fourth militia clause. That's what it concerns. We call it the Second Amendment. Be assertive. Mail a copy of this book to your state legislators, your congressman, and the president of the United States. Then follow your constitutionally protected right, that is your duty, your responsibility, constitutionally protected under the fourth militia clause, the Second Amendment, and fulfill that responsibility. First, complete a good safety marksmanship course. Second, get a good firearm and ammunition. Third, stand relaxed and ready to respond to your state legislature when they pass the Militia Act. I hope they do if you push them hard enough. And only as you follow in self-control the supreme law of our land, the supreme law of our land, which is another word for due process, only as you do that will you have freedom and security at the same time. Freedom and security at the same time. That's what the militia clauses are designed to achieve. And the authority of the militia of the several states, according to our Constitution, I'm quoting, is to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And this, friends, neighbors, and kin, is the supreme law of the land. And I take Noah as an example. Noah focused on the safety for himself and his loved ones. And by focusing on his immediate responsibilities, he saved the entire race of man from annihilation. And so also you, by focusing on freedom for yourself and your loved ones, you can save the freedom of your land, your entire country. I really believe that. I believe that's God's pattern for positive change, is a critical mass of the remnant, sometimes just a remnant of one. And as old Luther used to say, God plus one makes a majority. Now, that concludes that part. Most of the book, I kind of went through it, summarized it as I went. I hope next time I'll be able to read through what I have at the end of the book, a pattern state militia statute.
pursuant to the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16B. And I wrestled over this. I kind of did it from scratch. I got some ideas from some other people. Of course, I'd been reading some of the old militia statutes of our first fathers before our country was founded, the colonists, and what happened in Puritan New England and how they fashioned the militia according to the common law to fit their rustic circumstances in the wilderness. And also, I did even get some information from the militia of that incredible group of Dutchmen down in South Africa that defeated the most powerful army. Well, they had them on the skids. They didn't ultimately prevail, but they had them down, the British Army. And it was a militia that did that, the militia of the Dutchmen down there in South Africa during the Boer War. Farmers, just farmers. I shouldn't say just farmers. They were very effective in what they did. I took some information from the way they did it, how they chose their officers, because I thought it was a biblical point of view and a common law point of view. So maybe we can look at that next time, or at least start to look at it. By the way, this booklet, we've been going through the principles it presents, is available at www.commonlawyer.com. Just click on the button that says books. You can see it there, a description of the book. Militia of the Several States, it's a brief. It's an introduction. It's a primer, a primer, as they used to say, on the subject. You can find it, I think, too, at Amazon.com. But either way, get a copy of the book if you're so inclined, and prime your pump on these four militia clauses. I hope we're not done. We'll continue, Lord willing, if I'm allowed, next week to continue to talk about them. Thanks, John. And that's all I have for today, for just talking anyway.
Okay, thank you, Brent. We'll open up Q&A if anybody's got any questions for Brent, *6. Let me open it up. All right, *6 to get into the queue if anybody's got any questions for Brent. We have Eric, a VoIP dialer. Go right ahead, Eric. What state are you calling from?
Georgia. This is Eric in Georgia. Okay, thank you. Last week we were discussing, talking about having ideas consonant. We were discussing a court of record, and I just want to make it clear that from the NLA's point of view, what NLA teaches is that a court of record has five requirements. Keeping a record is only one of them. It keeps a record of the proceedings. The tribunal is independent of the magistrate. The court proceeds according to the common law, and it has the power to fine or imprison for contempt. And sometimes, the fifth thing is sometimes that it has a seal. It doesn't have to. That's optional. And then this superior court, that this court is that I'm speaking of, it's referenced in Ex Parte Watkins, cited by Schneckloth versus Bustamante, and it says, the judgment of a court of record whose jurisdiction is final is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. And that court, of course, is SCOTUS. It is as conclusive on this court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to inquiry concerning the fact by deciding it. So I just thought that was important because last week it was brought up, and from a listener, not someone who's Brent or NLA leadership, it just seemed a little that we didn't really nail it down tight and fast, and so I wanted to bring that up. And then, you know, if there's any objections
Well,
to
let me comment on that a little bit. I don't know if Brent wants to comment. You know, the key thing to a court of record is the fact that there is a jury. That's the key, okay? There has been some misunderstanding, I know, from the perception of a court of record being taught by certain individuals. I know, what's his name? I can't think of his name. Bill Thornton. Okay, Bill Thornton, you know, his position or his opinion and what he has concluded is that the king of the court is the sovereign of the court. Our position is that the king of the court is God. God, Christ is the king of the court. And the sovereign of the court, the court belongs to the sovereign, okay? The plaintiff coming in, bringing in the case against whoever. But when it comes to a criminal situation, which is where there is now a required jury, no one can take you before, no judge can make a decision on whether you committed a crime or not and then make all the decision on their own and give you a jail sentence. That is not due process. That is not the way our law is set up. What is required is that there be an indictment, number one, so the people have to decide to say, yeah, there's a problem here, we think. Let's dig deeper. Let's get a jury involved. And then the jury must come in and make the decision, guilt or innocent. And ultimately, the jury is to decide the consequences for the individual that, has injured someone else or whatever the case may be, if there's a crime and what needs to be done. That's the process of law, and that is a court of record. Anything outside of that is not a court of record. It can be challenged. It can be appealed. A court of record cannot be appealed. If the individuals in the jury somehow violated an individual's unalienable right and becomes knowledge to the Supreme Court or a higher court, not a higher court than us, but to the Supreme Court, they do have a duty to do something to protect that person's rights. And the Supreme Court has talked about this. As a matter of fact, Williams makes a reference of this kind of an idea. As long as they don't trench upon an individual's rights, they can investigate and do whatever is necessary. But let me read a few things, which will be part of what you had said, ex parte Watkins, and also Bastamante, Schneckloth versus Bastamante. I'm going to read that entire, not the entire decision, but more of a larger paragraph of that, and some other, there's also Jones versus Jones. But let's read this one. The decisions of a superior court may only be challenged in a court of appeal, okay? So let's think about that. The decision of a superior court can only be challenged in a court of an appeal. The decision of an inferior court are subject to collateral attack. In other words, in a superior court, one may sue an inferior court directly rather than resort to appeal to an appellate court. Decisions of a court of record may not be appealed. It is binding on all other courts. However, no statutory or constitutional court, whether it be an appellate or a Supreme Court, can second-guess the judgment of a court of record. The judgment of a court of record whose jurisdiction is final, that's the people, their jurisdiction is final, that's a court of record. Where that is final, is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. And this is the United States Supreme Court speaking here. It is conclusive on this court as it is on other courts. So the people are above the United States Supreme Court. That is the point. You cannot second guess the decision of the people. There is no higher authority. And that's why we need to be very, very careful in these courts, because we're sitting on the king's bench, and the king's bench, that king in that bench is God, okay? And that's how we have to understand this. This is the law of the land. We have unalienable rights. We have covenanted with God. We called upon God through the Declaration of Independence. And we sealed it up in our Constitution, and especially when the Bill of Rights was written, We're coming forward saying we have unalienable rights. This comes from God. We want God to be our judge. It puts an end to inquiry concerning the fact by deciding it. And that's ex parte Watkins, 3 Peter, and also Schneckloth versus Bustamante. Now, we have another thing here. It says a court of record, a judicial tribunal. Okay, this judicial tribunal is the jury. It's not a group of judges. It's not a judge. It's not a magistrate. It is the people. A judicial tribunal having attributes and exercising functions independent of the person of the magistrate, designed generally to hold its proceedings according to the course of the common law. Jones versus Jones. And one other we'll bring up here. And that is courts of record and courts not of record. The former, this comes out of Black's Law, the former being those whose act and judicial proceedings are enrolled or recorded for a perpetual memory and testimony, and which have power to fine or imprison for contempt. Error lies to their judgments, and they generally possess a seal. Courts not of record are those of inferior dignity, which have no power to fine or imprison, and in which the proceedings are not enrolled or recorded. And let's see, what is this? This is Henninger versus Davis, and there's quite a bit of information here on where this could be found. But the key thing is this. If it's a criminal court, it's not a court of record. Okay, you know, that has nothing to do with justice. You know, you have a court of record where jury, first of all, a grand jury comes in, they make the indictment. That's the people making the decision, not the government, not the judge, no one. Only the people can indict. Once the people can indict, only the people can convict. That's your jury. Judge has no power or authority there. When he sticks his fingers in the game and he tells the jury how they're going to rule according to the law, he is now tainting the jury. He's guilty of tainting a jury. There's no business telling that jury. Basically, he should be freeing that jury, giving them knowledge and understanding what their duties are, the oath that they took, and the fact that they have a very serious job and they have to look for restitution. They have to look and make a serious decision on what needs to be done, especially if it's a violent crime. So this is the difference. This is what a court of record is. A court of record is a court that comes in with a jury. That is the key. And their decision is final. There is no appeal. You know, people can appeal anything they want when a jury makes a decision. It can't be overturned or changed, or it shouldn't be anyway, unless, of course, there was an error found somewhere, you know, new evidence comes up. All those things are possible, and then things have to be reconsidered. But you can't take that case and turn it upside down on its head and change it. And I know judges have done these things. That's unconstitutional. It's unlawful. And that's the difference. It's not magic or anything here. And so when we open up a court of record, what we're saying is we're coming in with a jury. That's what we're saying. We're coming in with a jury. And judge, you have no authority to make a ruling here. You can't make any conclusions on this case. This is going to go before the people for decisions. And that's the key. I don't know if anybody else, Brent, if you want to comment on any of these things, go right ahead.
Oh, I just had to unmute myself, John. It's amazing that we are inundated with information concerning court records on the Internet. I'm finding really a lot of good information here. I'm just glancing through it, but you'd said a lot. Eric made the point, court record, in contempt, they keep a record of the proceedings, and that's the fundamental things. And that's what most of it. I found a site here that cites all of the statutes. Court's record in every state, and a lot of them, notice to mention the common law of England. The common law, the common statute law of England are adopted, for example, in Arkansas, amazingly. So, in the continuity of our law throughout our jurisdictions here, court's record important. And in the rest of the world, just to say this, draw the big picture, get the big picture, in the rest of the world, there are no courts of record, and just in common law countries. Courts of record is a special phrase used to describe something that's special to us. In most of the rest of the world, of course, there aren't any real juries. They have some window dressing kind of juries sometimes in some countries. But the judge takes notes. He takes notes, and the prosecutors in a criminal case, they take notes, and they give their notes to the judge of their interviews with the witnesses or interviews with... Everything is written, a lot of it sealed. It's not oral. You can't have a public trial unless it's oral. And our common law and our Constitution acknowledges this, demands Article 6, or, Amendment 6, rather, demands a public trial. That means it has to be oral. Well, if it's oral, then the words are to be recorded as is. And the seal, which was mentioned a while ago, is when it goes up on appeal, the court has a seal that, because it is the record, it's the verbatim record of the case is sent up on appeal, the seal has to be attached to certify that the record is accurate, it hasn't tampered with. So we have a lot of safeguards in place with courts of record. They are important. They are part of our common law tradition. They do not exist under the law of the city, which governs all of the rest of the world. They never think of such things. They don't care. They just want a powerful party, which is the state, to prevail and get its will. That's all that matters in those countries. Our country, we slug it out in battle by trial before the jury, and let the chips fall where they may. We follow due process. We don't worry about the result. Theoretically, we shouldn't. We should just worry about, are we following the law of the land, which is due process? And the courts of record are all about due process. It's a wonderful doctrine. I hadn't given as much thought as you fellows have. It's not something that's come up in my life, except just in the fundamentals. But I appreciate the discussion and bringing it up and worrying over it and mulling over it and bringing it to life. It needs to be thought about more. I agree.
All right, Eric, do you have anything else?
I do. I'll be real quick here if I could. I have a question for him, but before, just to what Brent was talking about, you know, he talks about what's on the squad cars in this police state of ours, and I always say that, well, I'll tell anyone who will listen, it should say, instead of to serve and protect, it should say to bully and profit from, or to bully and fleece. And then if it's going to say to serve and protect, it should say to serve and protect the state.
Really, I hear your dad.
But this,
if they're going to
feminine,
be honest anyway. Yeah.
Exactly, if they're going to be honest. But before my question, and I'm trying to be quick here, this feminine desperado, this grandmother out in California, and I'm a little under the weather, and forgive me if I'm being slow here, but what was she, why did her assailant, who was a giant compared to her, why did the FBI, the feds, want in on her? What was it that she was, how did she threaten his life, and why did it go across state lines, if you could, real quick on that?
Well, it's a long, involved case, and there was a lot of question in the case whether it was a setup by the federal government, because it was bizarre. I like all the cases, you know, they're involved, and they think that they're undercover type of secret agents half the time, and they've been watching too many movies, and all those things were a part of this case. It was beyond understanding, and the case went to trial. It was a long trial. So I can't answer all those questions. But the rest of the story is always as fascinating as what comes out in the public trial. And a lot of the things that were fascinating about that particular case never came out, and because evidence, although we believe that some of those things were true, we had every indication of it. We had no solid evidence to bring up at trial. And we hoped it would pop out. Sometimes it does in cross-examination. A fellow never knows what's going to happen. That's why we have cross-examination. By the way, cross-examination is unknown in the rest of the world. It's a creature of our common law. It has a long history, a fascinating history, that we can make statements by asking questions. We don't care what the answers are half the time. We just want to make the statement before the jury. So we put the questions in form of leading questions and make statements and make arguments. That's the engine of truth, of much greater surety than the oath by far, cross-examination. But those are the kind of things we don't want to lose, because those are tools in the hands of a death practitioner that can make all the difference in the world. I'm more interested, you gents are talking about the Bundy trial and Mr. Mumford, and it has raised my interest, piqued my interest, and the whole thing, and I'm saying, boy, I sure would like to, at this point, I'd like to get a transcript of that trial. It has to be good. It has to be. It had to be hard-fought. It had to be because it was so obvious what was going on, and of course the job of the attorney just try to get it pop out. But in the case I was speaking of, the things I said were true. It's bizarre, beyond the extreme, that these people were even being tried. And this fellow was a football player, a college football player. He'd stole millions of dollars, this big fella. The grandmother I was talking about, her husband dropped him to his knees. He took a swing at him, and this is a little guy, wiry little guy, about 60 years old, and the big fella took a swing at him, and he went in, smart move, maybe I've told this story on these calls, he went in immediately and grabbed him around the waist with his head down. Well, of course, when he did that, all the big fella could do is pound him on the back, and then he brought his knee up into his groin and dropped him. Well, that did come out in trial. That made the jury laugh a little bit. It didn't save the case, but everything about it was backwards and upside down. I
to this day don't understand all what happened and the answers in that particular case. But it takes wisdom to stay out of trouble. A fellow wrote a book many years ago. It was F. Lee Bailey. F. Lee Bailey. He's the fellow that defended Patty Hearst and defended, he was in the O.J. trial, F. Lee. And he was then debarred for mouthing off to the judge. I think it was contempt. I don't remember. But he wrote a book after the book, The Defense Never Rests. He wrote a book called How to Stay Out of Jail in California and Other Dangerous Places. How to Stay Out of Jail in California and Other Dangerous Places. I believe that was the name of the book. But he was making the point in a police state that just takes wisdom. And California is as bad as any. It takes wisdom to stay out of jail, to stay out of the way of the government. They're looking to justify their position, their job. They're looking to bust heads, to have fun. And I know, there are good cops out there. But the burden's on them to justify that, because the overwhelming mass of the police state culture and the government dependents that have the power to bust heads, carry guns and clubs and whatnot, whips, have people thrown in cages for nothing, it's out of hand. There's no question. And this whole situation with Mr. Mumford, God bless him. He was just trying. He was doing a good job. Doing his job. What did he get arrested for? He got arrested for doing his job, for doing his duty under the Constitution. Defending his client. Giving him a fair trial. Seeing to it that he had a fair trial according to the Sixth Amendment. A fair fight. And he prevailed. They didn't like that. He prevailed. Well, really, I should say his client did. But he was part of the battle. Battle by trial. Got it backwards. Battle by trial before the jury there in the Oregon courtroom. Well, that's what I know about that case. The particulars of it, I don't know all of them. But that's what I learned when I was involved with it, the case of the grandmother.
All right, let's go on to the next caller. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, John.
There's not that many people in the queue, so if you want to come back in again, you come up in a few minutes anyway.
I appreciate that.
We do have other people. Okay.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. We're going to go to next caller, which is a wireless caller, 616.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen. I've got
first name and state.
Oh, my name is Joe. I'm calling you from the People's Republic of Illinois. I have a comment first I'd like to make to Mr. Brent. Have you ever considered, have you ever considered doing books on tape? Like your voice has such a nice cadence and your inflections are so perfect that I could listen to it, even if you were reading the Constitution to me backwards would be kind of enjoyable, I think. But
I've heard that one.
So, yeah, if you've done any books on tape, I'd be interested in purchasing those. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there is a book available on tape. I tried that once. It's my commentary on the Constitution. It's a book of a couple of hundred pages. A Common Lawyer Comments, United States Declaration of 76 and U.S. Constitution. And I read that book and made recordings, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that that's available on the website. Go and look. Just click on the button that says books, www.commonlawyer.com, and I believe that it's available there. If it isn't, it ought to be, and I'm going to try to get somebody to get it up there. If I have time, I do others. If I had somebody who could read them that is a good reader and likes to do that, and I do have a couple of people that ask about that. I need that. There's a radio station out there that I came in contact with last fall that reads the kind of stuff I write. They just read it over the radio. That's all they do, read books. And they asked me for permission to do that, and I need to find out what their call letters are, where they are, so that if anybody's interested, I need to be able to say it. Here's where it is. You can go to hear these kinds of books. So, the guy that does it, by the way, is a truck driver, but he likes to read, and he likes to read out loud, and so he reads books out loud. God bless him. You know, faith comes by hearing, and I know my books aren't, the Bible, for crying out loud, but we need the Bible on tape, too, and it's amazing to me that the Bible was never read on tape until the 1950s. And the guy that did it was a fellow by the name of, he was a famous American actor, so famous, I can't remember his name. It's escaped me. Of course, he's gone now. He did a chapter a day for years until he got all, about 1,500 chapters, whatever it is, got them all done, did an excellent job.
And I still think he's the best man to ever read the Bible. I've heard a lot of reporting since. I've never heard any better than his. His name started with
an S.
His name
is Scorby, is it? Alexander
Scorby?
That's
it, Alexander. Yes. He was from New York City.
Yeah.
Alexander Scorby.
Very
yeah,
good
very
reader. Yep.
Yeah,
so we've got access to that. That could be read. You can go online and just Google it, and you can download and listen to the Bible being read by him.
Well, Brent, I think you're missing a whole career path, so I'll just leave it there because I'd love to hear something read by you. But the reason I called in tonight is actually I stumbled upon you guys quite by accident. I was looking up information on habeas corpus because I may be arrested myself here soon. And it all revolves around my criticism of malicious prosecution. I have I served this country for 10 years as an Army Ranger until I couldn't stomach that anymore. And oh, by the way, going back to your comments on Wright, I agree 100%. And I think probably the best analogy I ever heard on Wright, and I think Wright's. My personal belief is rights only apply to human beings because human beings are the only unique creature created by God that can reason and reflect. And, of course, rights are directly tied to that reason and reflection, and it's the exact reason why you've never seen a lion put on trial for murder, for murdering a zebra or a gazelle. So that
even,
being,
yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so that being said, we do have rights, and those rights weren't given to us by the Constitution. They were given to us by God, and we have responsibilities to those rights that is unique to our own creation. But specifically, you know, I've kind of always fought my own battles coming out of the military into the civilian life and being attacked, and I kind of learned it along the way, and I've hacked my way through it and been fairly successful. But unfortunately, now I have a loved one who's a victim of it, and he cannot represent himself, and I'm not really competent enough to advise him. But one of my questions was, and I have a few, but does a person take on a special status when they are represented by a barred attorney?
Well, what happens when they're represented by a licensed attorney? He may be barred. He may be a member of the bar. He may not. Depends upon the state. Some states are bar membership for licensed attorneys is required. Other states it is not. If the bar of the state requires membership, then the bar of the state is responsible for discipline of attorneys. In states where bar membership is not required, the Supreme Court, the highest court of the state, is responsible for the discipline and licensing of attorneys. That's the difference, and that's the two systems that are used throughout the country. But the importance about having a lawyer, I've had one on different occasions in some pretty tough situations, I might add. And it wasn't because I couldn't do what the mechanics of what needed to be done. I suppose I could have done it. And I did until I thought that I could afford to have him. I tried to carry it as far as I could in one case. But I have another lawyer, that is him. I'm referring to my lawyer. Here's what it does. A lawyer creates a perception before the jury. It creates a perception that you've got a licensed lawyer that believes in your case. If you represent yourself, you're just you talking about yourself, pumping yourself up, and that's not what we need. You know, even before the Creator, we have an attorney. The Bible used the word, 1 John, parakaleo. That was the term of a family lawyer under the Roman law, parakaleo. Para means beside, kaleo means to call. And it says in 1 John that we have an advocate before the Father. Well, advocate's the Latin civil law of the city word. But what ultimately it means is you got a pleader. You're not pleading your own case. You've got one that does it for you. And because you've got one that does it for you, it creates a different perception for the jury. Here's what the jury looks for. The jury looks for a lawyer that they like. And if they like your lawyer, they'll like you. if they like your lawyer, they'll like you. If they respect your lawyer, they'll respect you. And a good lawyer in a trial like that will make sure that he appears to be part of you. He'll sit close to you. He'll even pat you on the back once in a while. He'll make it look like, if it's natural, it's better. You don't have to make it look that way. It's not an act. If you've got a lawyer that believes in you, he'll do all those things. These things are not mechanics. These things a man representing himself or a woman cannot do. And that's the way God made our tradition. Our tradition of seeking justice, he himself requires that his son represent us before him. And if you've got a judge whose son is the representative, you've got a good lawyer. We've got that, ultimately. But let's play that analogy on out in the governments among men. That's why it's important that if a man at all can, that he needs a lawyer that believes in him. And that part about believes in his case and wants to defend him is important. It has to be down deep in his core. You can find a man like that. This Mumford, I get the impression, what I read about him out here in this Oregon case, he believed in what he was doing. The issues, the questions were sharpened in his mind because he was indignant about, that's what I gather. Maybe I'm wrong, but I gather that. He was indignant about what was happening. And so that's important that perception is there, that you've got a lawyer. And if the people respect it, I've been in cases where lawyers have, when it came time, their time for cross-examination, I'm thinking of one in federal court, all of the clerks that could be spared came up to listen to him slowly but surely carve apart and draw blood out of the government's witnesses. He was incredible at doing it. And he wasn't belligerent. He wasn't nasty. He was just a slow, methodical surgeon, and just ripped them apart quietly and kindly. And that created a perception in the jury that he was a kind man, but he took command of the courtroom without being an overbearing man. It was amazing to watch. It's a lot about personality. Not everybody has a personality to do this, that, or the t'other. But the perception of respect that a lawyer can create will be transferred, the jury will transfer it to the defendant in a case such as that. I can't overemphasize that. I've seen it. It works. That's the way human nature is. It's a law of nature with all of us. If I were on a jury, I would be prone to feel the same way. I want to see somebody that believes in the defendant, that is willing to put their reputation on the line for who he is and what. And there've been plenty of lawyers through the history of our country and in England. You read their stories. I'll tell you, if you want to read a good book and drive this home to you, get a book. It's still in print. It was written over 100 years ago. The name of the book is The Art of Cross-Examination.
I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
Oh, it's worth reading over and over again. And all the fella did was compile the records of cross-examinations. Now, in my book...
Who's the author of that?
A fellow by the name of, I'm trying to think of just a minute. I'm sorry, I don't remember. It's kind of a funny name. He was a man from New York City. He hadn't been a prosecutor for many years. But if you just type in The Art of Cross-Examination, it'll come up on the Internet. But I was going to say also, I have a cross-examination, the record of a cross-examination, and my chapter on cross-examination and excellence of the common law. That may be of interest. Two or three. A couple of short ones and a longer cross-examination to make the point. And by the way, the cross-examination in that book is my cross-examination of that 6'5" fella in that case in California that was that got dropped to his knees. He was brought in court in chains. He was already convicted of other crimes, and I ended up cross-examining him on the standing on the backs of the other men that have gone before me, that went before me just before that, and cross-examined him. I was fortunate in that case. I had a lot of information to get at him with. And some things popped out during that cross-examination that were important and may have made the difference for my client. I don't know. But at any rate, that may be of interest to you.
Francis L.
Right,
Wellman.
Well, let's take that next
Francis.
That's
it. Francis. Francis somebody. Yeah, that's right.
Francis L. Wellman is the author.
Wellman,
of that.
Okay.
Yeah, the reason I ask is more on a legal basis. Does it deprive a person of any constitutionally protected rights to be represented? Okay.
No.
They don't.
Oh no.
The court
no,
doesn't
no.
see them as a ward or someone who's in. Because I had heard this from several other forums that you're considered an infant or someone who's not cognitive or cannot.
Well, let me just pipe in just a second here. The problem is the system that they've turned our courts into is the problem. And to go into, especially if you're going up against the state, to go into these courts that are really violent against the people who are trying mm-hmm. to get justice, this is the problem we're having. And it's very difficult to go in with a lawyer who will really battle your case the way it really needs to be battled. Now, I think once we get into the other side of things, and when I say the other side of things, in other words, we bring back our courts back into the common law, under the common law, and the people get control of the jury process, and we have untainted juries. When we get to that point, now I think what Brent is bringing up is a proper way to go, and yeah, you know, a lawyer could play a very important role. But you have to have a lawyer that's not bound and in the club, so to speak, and where the judge will pull him aside and say, hey, this is the way you're going to behave in my court, and you're not going to go here and you're not going to go there, where the individual should be able to go wherever they want to go if they're trying to bring justice into the court.
These courts
we have out here are not interested in justice. They're interested in the civil law and bringing the statutes to play and exercising them and not justice.
Yeah, you're exactly right. In fact, the case about the attorney who was surrounded by federal agents is a classic example. There's statutes in several states. I don't know what they are, but there's statutes in multiple states, maybe even in every state, that covers an attorney from being even encumbered or arrested or stopped by the police if he's on his way to court. So having federal agents surround you while you're arguing for your client is, again, a war upon the Constitution. And this is something that has brought
great pain. Well, those agents did what they did because the judge allowed them to do it. They already knew they had forego, that you can go do what you got to do. They just wanted them shut down. Now, they may play it off some other way to try to get a story out as if the judge had something good to do about the whole thing. But, you know, if the judge was going to do the right thing, that judge should have had all those marshals put in jail.
Yeah, I
agree.
Assault. And I definitely want to pick up this torch and run with it, because I spent 10 years of my life and lost an inch of my height, along with a few other scars, to try to defend our republic, only to find out all the bad things that have been going on and are still going on. And I don't expect Trump to save us from everything.
It's going to take the people. Only the people can save America. Donald Trump can't do it. I mean, he may be the right guy for what our needs are and help to empower us and to get us into play here. But it's going to take the people. The people have to get up to do it. You know, that was the big problem with the Ron Paul movement. And the Ron Paul movement had a lot of young people. And so they weren't matured enough. They haven't really received any wisdom yet. Wisdom comes with age. And, you know, when the whole thing was said and done, they just walked away, most of them. Not all of them, but a good deal of them. They kind of disappeared. A lot of the young people disappeared. They didn't continue in the play. And they really thought, and Ron Paul even said it, you know, look, I can't make everything right. Even if I get into office, I can only do so much. And but it's up to the people to do it. And the people have to come. We have to have that critical mass. And we believe here at National Liberty Alliance it's going to be done in the court. That's how we're going to take this nation back. We take the court back. We take everything back.
You're 100% right. And I will tell you from personal experience, because I always represent myself. Whether that's a mistake or not, I don't know. But
in this court environment, it's the best way to be, because I always represent myself too. It's the only way to be in this court of environment. But unless you got into a court, look, if you're arguing a case where the judge has no play in it, in other words, it's not against the state, and he's not buddies with this lawyer or that lawyer, and he's really trying to do an honest thing here to keep that case going, and to put it under common law. Then if it's a jury trial or even if it's under equity, and he's going to make the decision if you've given them the permission to do so. But, you know, you could get some justice, and having a lawyer come in could be very helpful. So I agree with that. But in the environment, the way it is, and especially the cases we're dealing with, which is really cases of abuse against the people, against the Constitution, war and against we the people, you know, in these cases, we're not going to get anywhere with a lawyer in there. The lawyer is going to be restrained, restricted, and threatened, and so on. You know, they'll try to do that to us, too. But if we have the numbers behind us and we have enough of this going out where people are watching and seeing, they get frustrated with us because they don't know what to do with it. They can't pull us in the back room and tell us to shut up because that'll make us yell even louder.
It's a different story. They can if there's one or two of us. But if there's 200
right.
of us or 1,000 of us, it's better. But I've actually had judges tell me from the bench, to my face, there's no common law, and I've had another judge tell me that I had to prove myself innocent. And when I asked that judge, what law or statute are you referring to and how it applies to me, she looked me dead in the eye, totally serious as a heart attack, and told me it's the law of reciprocity. So that's what we're dealing with.
Was that a city court or a town court or a village court, or was that a Supreme Court?
That was a municipality. It was like a county court.
Yeah. Those people are so ignorant. It's pathetic, and it's really, really bad down there. I mean, I've heard
ignorant.
The dumbest, most ridiculous things said down there.
Yeah, and most of what I've done for myself, I've done much better without an attorney. But it's all been not necessarily glib and to form. But I was taught to operate behind enemy lines, so I'm more of an insurgent type of fellow than I am an actual operator. But I do have a case currently that I think is such a gross miscarriage of justice. I have one son sitting in jail since October of 2015. I have another son who in June of 2015 was threatened to be exposed for drug abuse and homosexuality and to keep himself in good standing with his family. He accused his older brother, my other son, of raping him. And he believed that would give him license, which it did, to come out of the closet and do whatever he wanted. But his mother, who he reported it to, trumped him once, said, you got to report this to the police. And the police took what they call a care video. And in the care video, of course, they loosen him up with some inconsequential banter. And then they ask him significant questions, which he can't answer. Then they ask him leading questions and coach him through it. And based on that, they develop what they call a complaint, and a detective acts as the complaining witness, and the judge's name appears on the document, but there's no signature, and there's a rubber stamp from the prosecutor. And based on that, my elder son, who has never laid a hand on this young boy, sits in jail, and not only in jail, but in a jail where they feed you chopped something on two slices of white bread and don't turn the heat on. And he's in Michigan, of course, and it's kind of cold there right now. Being charged with the crime, of course, now he's threatened by the other inmate. So what does one do when somebody makes an unfounded allegation against them to get themselves out of this?
Well, in a real court of record, you know, in a court where you're going to get a trial by jury, you're going to come in and make the argument, there's got to be some kind of evidence or proof. And if one person makes an affidavit and swears on it, and the other person swears the opposite way and there are no other witnesses, you don't really have anything, do you? I mean, you know, one of them is lying. But at least that would be a standoff, and if there's evidence, then it would take it one way or another. Usually what I've seen is in the, you know, basically very few people really do affidavits. The lawyers don't have their clients do affidavits, generally speaking. They do an affirmation for them, and that's second-hand information. That's irrelevant from my perspective. That's, they're really filtering their client, and their client can kind of lie by talking to the lawyer. Then the lawyer comes in and makes the sworn statement. Well, the lawyer's not lying. He can't be held accountable, but the other person wasn't under a sworn statement. Now, there may be... And then there's a matter of interpretation between what the lawyer say, thinks that the person said or what they did say or whatever the case may be. But I can tell you, I've seen these people come in, go into court and lie, and they would never lie if they had to put their hand on the Bible and swear, or if they had to write an affidavit. And most of these court cases are done without juries. It's just a judge there. And again, if it's going to be a criminal situation where, you know, life and limb is in jeopardy, then it must be the people. The people must decide, not a judge, not a magistrate. The people have to do it. But, you know, it sounds, again, what kind of a court was he in on this? Was this in a state Supreme Court, or was it in a municipality court? Where were they?
It began in a district court in Livingston County, Michigan, which has a reputation for running a very profitable system. And in fact, mm-hmm. they've built onto the jail there because now they're not only charging regular inmates $60 a night to stay there, but they're also charging federal inmates $250 a night to stay there. So it's a profitable system. Of course, the prosecution has a reputation of charging everyone with everything and letting the jury occasionally sort it out. But they have, in my opinion, colluded with the sheriff's department to develop a environment where they can put prisoners in, where it's too hot, too cold, unfed, unwatered, sleeping on a metal plate. Yeah. And then
we hear this all day long, everywhere. This is going on everywhere. It's very sickening.
Yeah, they're extorting. My son at one point said, I'll plead guilty to anything to get out of here. And I had to tell him from my experience as a soldier that, look, you're shot down behind enemy lines right now. You have to resist. And I basically took him through all the elements of, you know, being a POW, because that's how I was trained. And it's, while I was doing it, I was shocked beyond belief that I'm having to tell my son, who's in my country, how to exist in Hanoi Hilton.
Yeah. It is a pretty serious problem. Well, look, we have to get to the other side of this, and you know, I do think that this is the year that we're going to make it to the other side. I think we're making moves in a way that is going to really befuddle these people. And we might be able to get, our wedge in that door and pry it open and flood the courts with justice again. And that's what we're really working for. And that's going to take the people to get up behind the effort of what we're doing, or the effort behind someone doing this. I'm not aware of anyone else doing what we're doing.
Can I force a grand jury to be seated? Is that a possibility? Is that something that an individual?
Well, we've come to you understand how we're structured, how we did it, what we're doing.
No, I'm as I said in the beginning, I was kind of stumbling through this studying writ of habeas corpus because I've been very vocal about.
Well, let me just give you a quick idea of how we're structured, and then we need to move on to someone else because we've got other people, but I do appreciate your call here. But let me give you an idea of what we're doing and what we've done. We started out with just a couple of people here in New York, and we were just doing New York, and we ended up having a lot of people come to our meetings, which was online on a protocol type thing like this here and the free conference call, but we're on a different program. We used a couple of different until we got to this one. But the thing is we started getting people from other states, and so we told these people from other states, hey, you know, you can copy our website and do what we're doing in your state. And then we realized, we had more and more people. We realized that this needs to be a national thing. And at some point in time, we came to realize our battle is in the federal court, not in the state court. Because if you can win in the federal court, you'll take down the state court right behind it. If you win in the state court here, you're not going to necessarily do anything for Jersey or Connecticut or Texas or California or whatever. So things sort of grew, and we came to understand things better and better. But what we did is we went from county to county across this entire state and eventually across the entire nation, where people would come in to sort of put their vote that they would like to see a common law process brought back in, a common law grand jury and trial juries. And it's been pretty, almost 100% of the, once in a while you get a troublemaker, but generally speaking, it's just been almost 100% across the board as we moved across the nation. But so we then created what was called the Unified State Common Law Grand Jury, where the counties within the state came together, and they're acting as one under a state grand jury. Then all of the states, we've got 50 states, and we are in all 50 states. We have addresses in all 50 states. We have seals in all 50 states. And we then formed together what's called the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. And that is the pivoting point. That's the pinnacle. That's the push. And so all the people in all the states are pushing together under the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. They understand this now. They understand how we're structured and how we did this. We're not a couple of people out of a couple of counties or one county or one little corner of the state. We are the people in every state of the union. We are the people across the counties. We got thousands of members and many, many more thousands of people who are following us. So the point is we've been filing papers in the courts and all 94 federal district courts, and we've been doing habeas corpuses. We've only had a couple of small successes with habeas corpuses, but nevertheless, we've had a couple. And we've had a lot of successes in different ways. By being thrown out of the court, for us, is a success, just getting away from underneath their claws. But the bottom line is that we've now come to the point where we realize, okay, well, you actually opened a case. They don't want to respond to the people's report of subversion against the United States of America by enemies both foreign and domestic in every level of government, from the federal right down to the state and even into the local governments. They don't want to respond to that. So we opened a court case, and in that court case, we are bringing huge numbers of cases. We've got 30 or 40 cases of habeas corpuses that have not taken effect, and these people now have to show cause why not. We have the cause out there in Oregon, and we have the Robinson case in Montana, and we have the Bundy case in Nevada. We're working all three of those cases and other cases, and bringing them in. And we're going to be collecting juries for each one of these cases. Trials are going to go on. And we're putting on trial our government itself. Because, we have the right of redress of grievances. We want to know why they're doing what they're doing and why they're not doing what they should be doing. And so we're bringing in all three branches on the federal level for redress of grievances. We're bringing in all 50 governors. Well, we're actually notifying all 50 governors. We're not bringing them in, but we're doing information through this process. And we're going to be doing indictments within this court case. It's okay if they don't go out and arrest them. We'll do the indictments. We'll bring the process through. We'll get the juries together, and we'll get a trial going. And then we'll see what's going to happen after the trial, and they're found guilty or, if they let go, fine, if they're innocent. But if they're found guilty, let's see what they're going to do now, because we're going to be going through the process in the courts right here. This is our system. This is our courthouses. We paid for them, and we require them to bring the magistrate in as the traffic cop to do their job, and we're going to watch them like a hawk and prevent them from doing any damage, making any kind of decision. That decisions belong to the people, and that's where we're at, and we're going to see how that goes. But it's going to take really the critical mass, which we're close to. We've got almost 6,000 members right now. And tens of thousands of people sort of following along. We've got name recognition. And as people understand what we're doing, they get more and more involved. So this is the only way we're going to save America. There is no other way. Only the people can do it. You're not going to save America through the political process, because it's going to take the judicial process to enforce the true political process that's necessary through the committee man process to take control of the government. That's a top-down structure again. And we tried. That's where we originally started, was on the committee man trying to take the political process. But it's fruitless. You can't get in there. We took it to court, and that's how we discovered that the court was corrupt. But it was United States versus Williams that empowered us, we the people, to realize the power and the authority of the grand jury, and the fact of the matter that the grand jury can pull itself together. As a matter of fact, the very first grand jury that we know about, that's recorded anywhere, You know, it comes from Magna Carta. They mustered themselves together. They pulled the king off the side of the road and put the axe to his head and forced him to sign. And because he was breaking the law. And they wanted to get him back on track the way it should be. Now, again, people have every right. And this is what we did with the Declaration of Independence. Again. Now, here we are. We've got everything structured. Everything's there. The whole process is there. So, you know, it should be something that, you know, we should be successful in this. I think we're going to be successful. I think it's going to be this year. We've got to hit that critical mass.
Well, and I agree. And if you need an X-Man, please call me. I'm that kind of guy. But my last question is to, believe me, my friends accuse me of going over
we'll
the top.
Keep it kind of short because we've got other people. But go ahead. One short question. You can get back in line again, too, if you want.
I understand. My last question to Mr. Winters is anyone from Moonshine, Illinois, I just automatically want to meet. Do you do consultation services? Is there a way I could sit down with you and perhaps become more educated as a result and help defend myself and my loved ones?
Well, just go to the website, and if you go to the contact page, you can give contact or get contact information to me. It'll come to me if you put it there. And I leave your phone number or something, we could maybe talk. Would that work?
That'd be great. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'll do that. And then you can tell me at that time what's on your mind.
Great.
And you can always find him here also on Monday nights. So.
That's right.
Okay. Let's move to our next caller. Thanks a lot, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
David Whistler, go right ahead.
That's Dave here in Missouri. I'm kind of belated in going to these meetings because I've been on a sick list for 2 or 3 weeks, maybe even longer. So one of the questions I want to ask you, John, was, and I got a question for Brent. The question from you is, have we got any feedback from Donald Trump on the information that you had delivered to him?
Well, I understand that he recently just got it. We haven't heard anything yet back from him. We're expecting to hear from him in action more than response. We haven't required him to respond yet, show cause or anything like we would have done with this president, but this president's worthless even trying to do anything with him. So that's why we went after Donald Trump. So really, we're alerting him and making a connection and communications. He's not president yet, so he hasn't really even done anything wrong, but we do know some of his ideas and thoughts are wrong. We want to correct them if we can as soon as possible. But he has shown an interest in us. A couple of times there's been verbal interest from him with us and even asked for more information. We're about ready to file we've already filed the papers, but we're about ready to serve the papers, so we'll be serving him this week. And we also have heard through the grapevine, don't know how accurate this is yet, you know, you never know until it happens, that on the 11th he's going to be doing a press conference, and he's going to be talking about some of these issues that we're talking about, particularly what's going on out west. So we'll be paying attention to see if that truly does happen. His response to us that we're requiring, we want to hear how he responds to us through his inauguration. Okay, when he goes through that process and raises his hand and becomes the president of the United States and he gives his little speech, we're expecting to hear something about what not just we're doing directly necessarily, but what's going on in the courts and what needs to be done there. And the other thing is his actions in the first 100 days. But then after time, as time goes on, we'll see if we have to do some show causes with him. So right now there's no absolute requirement for his answering, just we're trying to educate him. And mostly of what we're doing is education. You know, look, we may not do things the way they do it. Not process or not necessarily the process, but the form that we use may be different from theirs. But there is no real true form when it comes to common law court. Ultimately, I mean, you know, the only thing required that makes a case prima facie and ready to go forward is an affidavit. That's the only thing necessary, really. Yeah, there's papers and things of that nature. You try to dot your I's and cross your T's. You want the names of the lawyers. And so there's a little structure there you try to work with. But if you're ignorant to it and you're making the battle and you're bringing the case, it's really about the facts. And that's what the jury is really interested in, hearing the facts. Has someone been injured? What's going on? What needs to be done? And so that's where we got to go with this. And we need to educate these people, not just the judges in the courts, but also, the president and our elected individuals. We need to get this down into the school systems. We need to teach our children about this, the common law, the process. We need to teach our children should be able to come out of school and be able to walk in a court and represent themselves, generally speaking. Okay, not for everybody necessarily, but generally speaking. So that's where we got to get to.
Okay. All right, I appreciate that answer. And Brett, I've got a question from you, whether or not you've heard about this. I got it over the internet. It seems like the head of the Homeland Security suggests that the government's taking over U.S. elections. Do you have any information on that? They're calling it a coup.
Yes. And I'd read that, too, on a number of sources. And it is, I'll just make a comment about it, even if I say it's unconstitutional for this reason. The Constitution requires that the federal government guarantee to every state a Republican form of government. And as long as the Supreme Court has said this, as long as the state of Ohio or New York or Montana, whatever state, as long as they send a congressman to Congress, and as long as they seat state legislators, that ends the matter, and the federal government has no jurisdiction to interfere. And it looks to me like these elections, of course, are all about fundamentally, among other things, but elected representatives, state legislators, senators, state congressmen, federal congressmen, senators, and happening. And the interference of Homeland Security is unconstitutional. Therefore, it is the right, that is the duty, the responsibility of every state governor to say flatly no. And if you do that, if you send your feds in here, they're going to have to come through us. We're going to assemble the state militia, the state police, whatever sources of power he has at his disposal, and stop you. Now, it's not wise to threaten that kind of a showdown unless it's a serious enough business and you mean it. And it's not enough to write papers in cases like that and write opinions and protest. You can do that. That doesn't work. It has to come down to what does the Constitution say and how far are you willing to go to ensure state jurisdiction, the right, the responsibility of state governments to be the judges of their own affairs. And that's what our Constitution demands. And so it's true from what I can gather. And one of the things I try to do and try to learn to do is try to get to the bottom of things and find the truth. And in the mass, all this mess of fake news that the mainstream media has been putting out, now I realize since I was a boy and I used to watch Walter Cronkite, I realize now that those were all controlled. When we had three networks, they learned to control, and then they learned to control the television. And it just got worse. And for the first time in our history, the lid has been blown off of that monopoly, and monopolies are against the individual, therefore they're against common law, as Coke used to say, Edward Coke. Well, that's what's happening here. A move of the evil empire to further enslave the American, and it must be resisted at all points. We do not approve, and we don't participate.
Well, the reason behind this supposedly is Russia's intersection in getting a troop elected president. They're still harping about that, and they're blaming this particular takeover on that subject matter. And I thought that was all cleared up.
Yes. Well, no, they'll continue.
I think that's because some people want war. That's what I think. And look at Donald Trump. I think is up there with Putin in the sense of not wanting war. You know, they've been pushing Putin into war, this administration, and it's we've been very close to it. And so, you know, this is a threat to the status quo here, because the status quo is war. And there's a lot of reasons why they'd like to get a war going, especially with Russia. That's the problem. You know, that's the problem. As long as enough people of America...
Do you suggest that we try to get a hold of our new governor in our state to try to find out what he knows about it and what he intends to do about it? Isn't he the one about Homeland Security taking over the elections? That means
let me let Brent comment on this, but before he does this, I just want to make a point. You know, look at. I'm disappointed in these governors. I'm disappointed in the states. I'm disappointed in their knowledge and understanding of our Constitution with all of these governors. Look at, you got the 17th Amendment, which destroyed the vote of the state. The state has no power, no authority, no say in anything that the federal government does, because they don't control their senators. And they allowed that to happen. Now, we've revealed this to them through information. We've sent it to all of these governors and many others, even their legislators, to remind them of the unconstitutional event that took place to get rid of the senators. And we don't need to go to reinvent the wheel. We don't have to do a constitutional convention. We don't have to do anything with the Constitution. All we have to do is nullify it. It's null and void on its face, because the Constitution itself, even it says you can't take away the representation of the state. And that was the purpose of the Senate. And the people are so ignorant that we don't even understand how this process works. You know, we have representatives, that go to congressmen. They represent us. What do we need senators for? Well, the purpose of the Senate is to represent the state legislators. The will of the state legislator, along with the governor, is to become the will of the two senators that is sent into Congress to get that point of view of the state. And they don't even realize that, what they've lost, and they don't even understand the fact that they can just call they can send their own two senators in and pull these two back and say, this is our right. You know, this is, we're a sovereign state, and we're sending our senators in. And if all states did that, and then they point, I think it's in Article 5, where it talks about the fact that you can't take away the vote of the state. And they've done that. So they can just nullify it by ignoring it and sending their own representation in. But it's an uphill battle. We're trying to, you know, do informations on the governors. We've included them in our court case for the sole purpose of giving them information. And we're not pulling them in to battle them with anything, you know, or to requiring them to do anything. But they are required to at least listen and consider. But unfortunately, I think they're either lost in their own corruption, their own greed, or their own ego, or something. Or just total ignorance. I don't know. Maybe a combination of all.
All right. Maybe, hopefully, we'll hear something from Trump by the 11th, and we'll go from there. Thank you both, gentlemen, for your time, and God bless what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Let's go to Kenny from Florida. Go right ahead, Kenny.
Yeah, this is Kenny from Florida. This is a question for Brent. Can you... go over the relationship between the Roman civil law and the popes of Rome, the papacy, and is that what caused the Reformation in the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries?
I heard the first part of it. You skipped that. You said the relationship between the Code of Rome and what?
And the papacy, the popes of Rome.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, the Code of Rome is called the Code of Justinian, and it now subsists throughout the world primarily in two forms. One's called the Code of Bismarck, the German Code, and the other is the Code of France, the Code Napoleon, which are essentially the same code. They just, Bismarck and Napoleon were egomaniacs of sorts and politicians, and they wanted their name on it, so they tweaked it a little, changed it. The Code Bismarck was put in place in the year 1900. I believe I got that just about right. And then Japan received the Code of Bismarck.
And that was the reason primarily for the World War, because we couldn't agree on an objective standard. They were under the Code of Rome, and the things that the Code of Rome said they could do, we didn't agree. We had an objective standard that was different, and so we ended up settling the matter on fields of battle, as MacArthur put it, on the Missouri, and that settled it. And they've been subdued ever since, but it wasn't presented that way necessarily to the public. But that's what war is all about. All war, all fighting, all violence, it comes down to you can't agree on the objective standard whereby to govern your relationship. It comes down to law. The Code of Rome, Code of Justinian, was adopted by the Roman Church, and it was done officially. You can go read about it in the book, Excellence of the Common Law. One of the chapters in that book, maybe two or three, I'm not remember, but I go through the history of how that happened, what the Pope said about it, how they put it in place. And the Code of Rome, then the Code of Justinian, the Code of the Roman Empire, became the canon law of the Church of Rome. So, again, with some changes and tweaking, every Roman priest is a Roman lawyer, or a lawyer of the law of the city, of the canon law of Rome. That's primarily the expertise of a Roman priest. It had little to do with the Bible, as much as Judaism had little to do, still has little to do with the Bible, has everything to do with the tradition of the elders. It's always a replacement of what is true law with something that is from the mind of man. And the Code of Rome is that. The Code of Rome, is, as a matter of fact, was called the Logos. And in the ancient world, the people that promoted it called it the Logos. And it is of no mean significance that John's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 1, says, "In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God." That was a slap in the face to that system of religion, law, and government called Babylon. Babylon, because the Code of Rome is the codification of the fundamentals of the code that arose out of the city of Babylon. That's just a brief explanation of what the Code of Rome is, the relationship between Romanism. As Gibbons put it, the Pope of Rome is the ghost of Rome sitting on the grave of Rome, and of course wielding the law of Rome. It's been that way since the beginning. It was a revival, the ghost of the old Roman Empire is what it boiled down to. And ever since that time, Rome has attempted to establish the old empire. You, of course, have the Holy Roman Empire, came later. Well, at the same time, Russia, don't miss this, Russia says they are the continuation of the Roman Empire under the Tsars, because when the Roman Empire was reduced to the city of Constantinople and fell to the Islamic Turks, an army of 180,000 of them, the manuscripts of the Code of Rome went to Moscow and was reestablished there with one of the nieces of the Roman Emperor. And that's when, from there, the Code of Rome is scattered throughout the world and governs most every country in the world today. And we are the exception, being common law countries. Even Islam is fundamentally the same as the Code of Rome, and it's most, although they don't have the code, the tenets are fundamentally the same. Well, that's enough for one evening on that subject, I suppose, but I hope that gives you an idea. I'd like to see you dig into it to understand that simple distinction. There are only two traditions of religion, law, and government in the world. One of them came out of Babylon. The other one is the truth. And then there are variations and all the confusion in between. But fundamentally, all religion, law, and government will tend toward one or the other. That's what the Bible teaches, and I see that it's true in history.
All right, let's take our next caller. Thanks, Kenny.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to, well, before we go to Eric, I just want to read this. This is Article 5 of the Constitution I was talking about for the senators. And this is extremely important for all of us to understand, to make our governors and our legislators of our own state to understand it, because they just don't seem to understand it. They don't seem to be interested in taking control of this federal government that's out of control. But it says here in Article 5 that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. And equal suffrage is the right to vote in the Senate. And they don't have that right to vote, so they have no say at all of anything that our federal government does. They have no representation. And that needs to be fixed. These governors need to understand that. They need to be talking with the legislators of their state. They need to get resolutions going and send their own senators there and fire the other two clowns that represent the state that have no power, no authority, no right of being or existing. The 17th Amendment is null and void, and all we have to do is just nullify it by ignoring it and doing what the Constitution permits. This whole process is set up in order to have an equal balance, checks and balances, and the state needs to have its say. But anyway, let's go to our next caller, Eric. VoIP dollar, what state you're from, Eric?
Georgia. Thanks for letting me back in. Temperance, tolerance, patience, humility. Patience is a virtue. I'm really amazed by John, Gerard, and Brent, your patience and temperance and tolerance. And then this attorney you were talking about, who was a gentleman and with surgical precision, he would break people down and stuff, and he probably knew this. But one time you were talking to a fellow on the call here, and he asked you a question, and you made your response, and then he said, "Are you saying I'm wrong?" And you said, "No, I wouldn't say that." And so you also mentioned about how God wants us to behave. And so I want to understand, if you can tell me from where the Bible, in the Bible this is, this temperance, this tolerance, how God wants us to behave. Because in my reading, in my Bible study, I haven't come quite across it yet. At least I haven't recognized it yet. But how God wants us to behave, can you tell me where I can find this as far as dealing with people? Because what I want to understand is, you know, sometimes I'm forward in my manner and I'm very willful, and I don't want to be that way. I want to, you know, to my eternal papa, I want to be a good boy in essence. You know what I mean? And then also, I see that it gets us farther along in life anyway. So that's the question.
Well, I think if you go read Isaiah 14 verses 1-23, it talks about wisdom and its seven pillars, and I think it's in 2 Peter chapter 1 verses 5-11. Which really identifies those pillars as virtue, knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, brotherly kindness, and charity. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that, and then what Brent, I think, I'm pretty sure that is what I'm talking about. But I don't really know exactly what I'm talking about, because Brent makes it sound like there really is a rule book for what God is saying, that, and I guess that probably is it. It's just I can't answer yes or no to if that's really what I'm after.
Let me just give a 2 cents here, and then I'll push it over to Brent. And my advice to anyone who doesn't really know the Lord is to go sit down at the feet of Jesus and follow him, out there in Judea. Because when he was speaking through time, not just in the geographical area. He was speaking to the people that were sitting there. He was speaking to me because he knew I would come and sit. And so he was speaking through time. And that's where we all need to be. Anybody that really wants to understand the law that's written in man's heart and to really be brought out is just go to the Gospels, the four Gospels. My suggestion to anyone who's never really read the Bible and really spent any time in the Bible, and they're just starting off, go to Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, then John, and when you're done, go back to Matthew again, Mark, Luke, and John. Just keep reading, because every time I read those Gospels, every single time, month after month after month, something new comes out every single time. You know, you go through the book, you start all over, and then you say, oh, I never saw this before. I didn't realize this. I didn't hear him say that. You know, it more and more comes. And then at some point in time, you're led through the rest of the Bible. And that's how it worked for me. I tried reading the Bible just starting in the beginning, you know, in Genesis. And I was kind of, to some degree, bored because I didn't understand a lot what was going on. And then you're getting into Leviticus and so on. But when I went right into the Gospels, that's where my interest was grabbed, and that's where we need to start. We need to start at the feet of Jesus. So if that's what I think that's what you're really trying to find, is looking at the law, you'll find it there. And you'll find it in every book of the Bible anyway. You'll find it in every verse. Brent, you want to comment on any of this?
Thank you, John.
Yes. Well, yeah, it's all over the Bible. I like to think of the verse comes to my mind often, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Now, that takes some explanation. Number one, what is love? That's a hijacked word. Doesn't mean anything but much to most people that I've discovered, and it takes a little bit of looking in the Bible to understand what that is. But John the Apostle gives us the point-blank answer. He says this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. That's simple enough. Do toward other people what God tells you to do, and you've loved them. Do not covet, lie, steal, commit adultery, or murder from your neighbor. That's the start. I want to throw one other idea out. And I used to pass these books out because they were, the fellow made such good points, and I had tried to do what he said to do years ago. And the name of the book, it's by a fellow named James M. Gray. James M. Gray. It's a little paperback, and it's How to Master the English Bible. How to Master the English Bible. And what he says to do, and he did it, and I tried it myself, he'd take 5-7 chapters and sit down and read it in one sitting. 5-7 chapters. For example, the Gospel of John's 21 chapters, I believe. He'd divide it in three parts, read 7 chapters in one sitting. Just read the first 7 chapters. And then the next day, read the first 7 chapters again in one sitting. Doesn't take long. And then the next day, do it again. Do that for 30 days. And if you divide the New Testament up, for example, and do that, then 2.5 years you will have read the whole New Testament, 30 times. And you'll know more than any preacher in 14 counties if you do that, maybe 14 states.
Amen.
Because you've actually given attention, read the original, not the original, in the original, but you've read the source document yourself. And boy, will you learn it. Now, you can do the whole Bible that way. And if you really want to be an educated man, forget the universities. Those are products of Rome. Forget the colleges. You want a real classic education, learn the laws of nature and the laws of nature of God. And that means the Bible. Read the Bible. Don't read about the Bible. Read the Bible. Don't read other people's comments about the Bible. God says he wrote it for you. You read it. It is the laws of nature's God. The law, as Blackstone calls it, the lex scripta, the law written, the will of God to man, what he wants for man. That's all. That's what the Bible's telling us. That's the crux, that's the gravamen of what that book's about. And how to get so you can do what he wants you to do. How do you do that? You do that through the birth of the Spirit. That's not, you don't do it, he does it. He does it to you. And but he explains there how all that happens. But I would suggest, John has suggested, Gospel. I think that John's a good place to start. Any of the Gospels are good. I like John because that's where I started, and so I've always had a fondness for John. And there are 4 Gospels for 4 reasons, because they're each one of them addressed to 4 different classes of men. Matthew is addressed to the Israelites to show them that Jesus Christ is the Messiah they're looking for. Mark is addressed to the Romans, whose motto was labor conquers all things. And Jesus Christ in the book of Mark never stops. He never rests. The word immediately occurs 43 times. He immediately did this, then he immediately did that, Mark. Then Luke was written to the Greeks to show the Greeks what they were looking for. He said, I found it. I found the perfect man, perfect mind, soul, body, and spirit. Well, that's, again, the Messiah. And then John is the cleanup hitter. And his gospel is written to show that Jesus Christ is the sovereign God. And it's written... It's the general gospel. It's written to all men. And that's like John, but all the rest are good too. And each one of us will fall at different times of our lives in one of those 4 categories and because of the cultural differences. In my observation, and all of them are good, and all of them, God will use any of them. The creator, the lawgiver, the only true lawgiver, is still there. And what a foolish race of men we are to not pay closer attention. He's giving us a book, for crying out loud. A book to tell us what right and wrong really is. Forget all the laws of Congress and the laws of the state, all that. We've got the true lawgiver as his thoughts exactly. And it is the final rule of faith and practice, as the Reformers said. They hit the nail on the head when they said that, and they're right. It is. They said this. Their cry was, ad fountain, back to the fountain, back to the source. We've got all these other things, but we've been too far removed the raw word of God in our lives. You want to be educated, a truly educated man. David said, no more than all my teachers. Why? He says, because I meditate, I ruminate on thy law.
thy law. What is law? It, which will not change. It's the way it is. It is what it is. It's the way pointed out with the index finger. Torah. That's the way pointed out. That's what the law is. The law is all the Bible. The law is what will not change. And that comes in many different forms. Poetry, Bible, epistle, letter, and the New Testament, apocalyptic, history. It's all there, and it reveals the standards of the only true lawgiver. But back to the beginning, yeah, the Gospels are good. I like John, myself, all of them are good. And that's just one way. God doesn't tell us how to read the Bible, how to learn it, except to learn it, read it, meditate upon it, line by line, precept by precept, as Isaiah puts it. Hear a little, there a little, quoting Isaiah, till you get it. And reading it over and over again, and every time I tried this, every time I read it, I said the same thing. He had the same experience. I mean, John the Apostle, John, he said he had the same experience every time he read the same thing. He saw things he had never seen before. It is an inexhaustible treasure trove of information, of wisdom. Every time I read it, here I am, and now I'm over 60, and I'm still reading, still fascinated at what I understand and the applications I can see from it. It is truly expired from this very breath of the lawgiver himself, and that's what Peter says it is. But I'll end with it.
It's
James
a never-ending book.
Yeah.
It's a never-ending book. In Ecclesiastes, God sums it up, I think, in Ecclesiastes at the last chapter, chapter 12, last five verses, and he says, the preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. The words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. And further by these, my son, be admonished of making many books. There is no end, and much study is weariness of the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And that's
Amen.
The conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. And as you read the Bible, you'll keep his commandments because, you'll start to have the attributes, the virtue, knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, brotherly kindness, charity. The Bible makes these things flow in us when we start to have that earnest, ongoing desire relationship with the Bible to do the will of God, to learn who this God is, the creator of the universe. And this is what then is to come out of us, to reflect who he is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Appreciate the question.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's
take our next caller here. Let's see. It is David VoIP dialer. David, your state?
Yeah, Missouri.
David from Missouri. Go ahead.
All right. Thanks, guys. Say, this is maybe a case that you guys don't know about. I know you know who the Pete and Dorian Henderson are, John. I don't know if Brent would. Her appeal basically was denied, and then she was put. She is still in prison, but her writ of certiorari, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, was also denied back in October. And basically, the long and short on this, Brent, because I have a question for you. She, under 18, under the terms of 18 USC 4013, was basically convicted of a single count of criminal contempt. Basically culpability for disobedience to orders commanding her to make and sign sworn statements under perjury containing content that was dictated to her by the government. And it had to do with income tax. I don't know if you've ever read or heard about the book Cracking the Code by Pete Hendrickson. But essentially they're denying her appeal. She was the Department of Justice tried to prosecute she and her husband earlier about content in their book and get them to swear that they didn't believe what they actually wrote in the book and tried to get her to change her testimony about her income tax filing. She was never convicted of any crimes other than contempt of court. And it boils down to being egregious misjustice about First Amendment rights here. But my questions are kind of boiling down to this. Recently, a writ of certiorari was denied in the Supreme Court in October, and she posed a couple questions which are obviously rhetorical, probably to all of us liberty activists. But my question to you, Brent, is if you'll comment on the collateral bar doctrine. Essentially, she asked, you know, two quick questions, and if I can, I'll read them, and then I'll let you kind of touch on them, if you would, Brent. The first question, can orders of a court commanding false speech, and particularly false testimonial speech, resistance to which is promoted a prosecution for alleged criminal contempt of court, be shielded from appellate constitutional analysis and determination by application of the quote-unquote collateral bar doctrine? And then a follow-up question, can a jury instruction, and both these things apply to her case, can a jury instruction removing from the jurors' consideration and determination the statutory element of lawful and explicitly instructing the jury that the unlawfulness or unconstitutionality of a court order is not a defense to a charge of criminal contempt be properly shielded from appellate review by application of this same collateral bar doctrine? So my question to you, Brent, is, I mean, since she's obviously been denied having that writ of that petition for a writ of certiorari by the Supreme Court, which I know isn't a judgment on whether or not she was right or wrong to even attempt to file it, but since she can't have these questions addressed and have that petition addressed by the Supreme Court, can you talk a little bit about this collateral bar doctrine, whether or not that was even a good approach for her to take? Is there any other remedy recourse that they might pursue in the meantime? So maybe just address that if you could, please.
Well, this sounds to me like I heard about this case a long time ago, I think, but I didn't follow it. I don't know exactly what happened. It sounds like that it's legal gymnastics to do what they're doing. And when it comes to, when it comes to, and that's complex, collateral bar, and you, I mean, who can follow it? Listen, if I can't sit and listen to what you just said and follow it, I guarantee the judges can't follow it either. And I'm not the smartest man in the world, but neither am I the dumbest. And if you can't make it simple, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about anybody. If they can't just make it simple so I can get it the first time they say it, it's probably not understandable at all. But I do know this, and this is the question that ought to be asked more and more. Is it lawful to force anyone to take an oath? Is that fundamentally lawful? Is it lawful to force a man to swear to something? Now, that's what you do when you sign a tax return. That's a forced oath. And forced oaths have been against our tradition for a long, long time. They've been tried over the years, and we're back to doing it again. And when these things arise about taxes in the courts, and this is the ugliness of income tax, it forces jurors and even judges to fear what they might do in a case. I'm on the jury. What if the juror doesn't come across and convict this fella? Are all of us going to be audited? Is my daughter-in-law going to be audited? Is my son-in-law going to be audited? Is my wife going to be audited? You can't tell me that that doesn't go through people's minds that serve on the jury, and you can't tell me it doesn't even go through the minds of judges. Because judges have been removed from the bench, and I've read the stories about it, and jailed because of their offense to the IRS. But it comes down to this, the forced oath. You see, the forced oath was part of the Star Chamber in England. You say Star Chamber to an Englishman, even yet today, that's like, it used to be here anyway, somebody would say something about a Yankee in the South, and people would say, damn Yankee. That was just the cultural habit. Well, in England, you say Star Chamber, they remember that from their own history, and it's not a pleasant memory. The Star Chamber was the place where they forced a man to take an oath, or a woman. And if you wouldn't take the oath, then they'd put you on the rack. They put you on the Duke of Exeter's daughter, they called it, because he was the duke that put that rack up there, and they'd stretch your bones out, or they'd put screws under your nails, or they'd lop off your ear or your nose. That's the Star Chamber, and the Star Chamber was put there to enforce the tax laws, fundamentally, just as the IRS are now charged with the same thing. And by the way, they use the same techniques. They maybe not go as far, but you throw a person in jail like this person you're talking about, You throw a person in jail like that, you take their liberty. When you take their liberty, you take their life. And when you take their life, you take their property. You cannot separate the three. When one goes down, they all go down to that degree. All three of them are the same, inextricably bound. And did this lady injure anybody? Did she commit a crime according to the laws of nature, the laws of nature's God? Or did she defend a system of income tax that's connected to the Federal Reserve Bank? We all know this now. We can read about it on the Internet. That's no mystery. Let's just be real about what's going on here. The same people that run the Federal Reserve Bank also run the IRS because that's the enforcement arm of the loans they make to government. That's the way it was in England. The same people that loaned money to the king did so on the condition that they got to run the enforcement arm of the tax laws. And they did. The Star Chamber was that enforcement arm. You can read it. Who's got time to read all that stuff? But it's all there. It's all there. And that's what's happening now. No question. I mean, the forced oath is the question. You know, the Bible says if you take an oath, Jesus Christ says this, if you take an oath, be very careful how you take it. Do not swear generally, he says. The translation, do not swear at all, gives a wrong impression. He said, do not swear generally if you choose to do that. In the Old Testament, we find that men can do that if they want, if they only swear by the maker of heaven and earth. And then we get to the New Testament, we find that Paul swearing oaths throughout his epistles to certify what he's saying. And it's not that we're not to swear oaths. It's not that we're not to make sworn statements if we believe that that's what God wants us to do. But if we do not believe that's what God wants us to do, like in the case of this lady, that's a violation of a person's conscience, his gathered knowledge in his mind, what he believes is right and wrong.
And can I say something really quick, Brent? Yeah, I mean, essentially, that's what the judge was asking the court to do, not only dismiss her testimony and her explanation of what she believed in, but they basically told her, they put a document in front of her through the DOJ and made this up because they had tried to prosecute her and her husband. Again, I know you don't know a lot about the history of this, and we're late in the night, so I'm not going to break it down. Anybody that's interested, I could tell them where to go find out about it. But they put a document in front of her essentially telling her, we want you to change your testimony about what you believed was true on your tax documents before, which we didn't find you guilty of anything. We didn't charge you with anything. We didn't prosecute you with anything. But because of what she and her husband had written in a book that was damaging the IRS and the government's case of getting people to continue to pay and file their income tax, again, I'm trying not to bind a trail here, she wouldn't do it. And like you said, they basically were commanding her through the court to perjure herself and to bear false witness and take a false oath. Because she refused to do it, they held her in criminal contempt just to make an example out of her and her husband because they're both very high-profile people.
What's their names?
Pete Hendrickson and her.
Oh, I know.
And Doreen Hendrickson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So again, the people that have tried to demonize them out there have said, well, they're criminals, you know, they've been found guilty by the court, but they're actually not found guilty of anything what you and I would call like tax evasion or anything criminal or frivolous having to do with the tax. They've basically been made an example out of for awakening and enlightening a lot of people out there about what the actual tax laws actually have to say. Again,
basically, this whole system, this whole jurisdiction is a jurisdiction totally unknown and off on its own and operates under U.S. 26 and U.S.C. Mm-hmm. 26. And even in U.S.C. 26, I forget the numbers, it says that U.S. 26 is not even law, okay? So they operate totally outside the system. And no other courts will get involved and touch those courts. Once they get you into those courts, it's like getting caught in the spider's trap. You know, it's very difficult to get out if you can. You want to stay out of that, and your battle really has to be to prevent yourself from getting into it. And there are mm-hmm. ways you could do that. But this is the problem. Look, when we get on the other side, we're going to fix this. This is not something we're going to deal with right now, but it will come up on our agenda soon. And actually, the whole system may be fixed before we even have to even get to that. Look, this system is going to collapse once we get critical mass and into the courts. Once the people get their control of the court back, and the people deserve, this is their court. This isn't their court. This is the people's court. And the king of the court is God. Once we can bring it back there, all these other things are just going to fall apart, and they're going to run under rocks and hide, because, you know, look at, they're breaking the law. They're abusing people. They're violating people's right of due process. They're warring against the Constitution and warring against the people. And we're going to get them for it. We're going to get them for it in a court of law. It's coming. It's a matter of time. But anyway, with that, I want to close down. We're 5 minutes over. Appreciate the call.
We'll pick you up again next Monday.
So, with that, Lord bless everyone, and Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And don't forget, on Thursday, we get together, same place right here at 9 p.m. With the Committee to Safety.